You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, takes on the world news.
Well, good morning. This is Jeff Blankford with the April 26, 2017 edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way on KZOX and Z the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. It is impossible to know what our world would look like today had the events of September 11th and the first year of our new millennium not occurred, or if the U.S. had responded more humanely in the days, now years, that followed. We can surmise, however, that it couldn't have been much worse, and I am speaking of just what has been happening within the United States. Outside of our borders, disasters can be seen in whatever direction one chooses to look. A week ago Sunday, it was the Turkish elections, where, if one chooses to believe the government's report of the close vote tally, a slim majority of those not imprisoned approved giving President Recep Tayyip Erdogan complete dictatorial control of what is no longer a democracy but remains a key U.S. ally. Today I will be looking at Venezuela, where each new day brings that country on the shores of the Caribbean ever closer to complete collapse, although some may argue that it already has. Only who is mainly responsible for this human calamity remains a question. My guest to discuss the situation and latest events there will be a Venezuelan friend, Professor Pedro Longshoreon, from the University of San Francisco's Department of Latin American Studies. He was last on this program in April of a year ago, discussing Venezuela's descent into the maelstrom and the Western left's inability to understand it. According to Pedro Longshoreon, both problems have only gotten worse. So tune in at 20 minutes past the hour to hear our discussion of the subject. Much of the Western world's attention this past Sunday was focused on France, where in the preliminary voting for president, as expected, far-right candidate Marine Le Pen of the National Front Party won 21.3% of the vote to secure a place in the May 7th runoff against Emmanuel Macron of the New En Marche Party, who topped the 11-candidate field with 24.1% of the tally. As anticipated, following the announcement of the results, the defeated candidates from the traditional major parties set aside their differences to offer their support for Macron in opposition to Le Pen, who, like her U.S. counterpart Donald Trump, campaigned largely on an anti-immigrant platform and taking France out of the European Union. The final vote on May 7th is likely to be a repeat of the 2002 election when her father and founder of the National Front, the unabashed anti-Semite Jean-Marie Le Pen, also finished second in the balloting behind the incumbent and eventual winner Jacques Chirac. What was as significant about Sunday's vote was that the two parties that have long dominated French politics, the Republicans and the Socialists, were swept aside by the voters. The Republican candidate François Fillon, the early favorite until dragged down by nepotism scandals, garnered 20.1% of the vote, and Benoît Hamon, candidate of the Socialists, the party of France's unpopular current president, François Hollande, limped in at 6.3%. The candidate favored by what there is of a left in France, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, from another new party, La France Insoumise, or France Unsubdued, finished fourth with 19.58% after newspapers as far away as Australia reported that financial markets were spooked by the prospect of a Le Pen-Mélenchon runoff. One might have said the same of the markets here had Bernie Sanders been the Democratic Party candidate instead of Hillary Clinton. That the candidacy of Trump, whose world viewpoint is not dissimilar from that of Le Pen, did not raise concerns on Wall Street despite his occasional fulminations against it, might be seen as an indication how far the American public has moved to the right or, as it turned out, Goldman Sachs and the dons of Wall Street knew their man better than those who voted for him. In my last program, I noted that Trump's decision to launch 59 Tomahawk missiles at a Syrian airbase following unsubstantiated reports that the Syrians had dropped bombs containing deadly sarin gas, killing between 60 and 70 people in the town of Khan Shaykhun in the Idlib province, had elevated his standing in the polls and among his critics. What I suspect what you haven't heard is that the Kurdish press, citing reports from the scene, reported the gas that caused the casualties was not sarin, but chlorine. In any case, each of the Tomahawk missiles cost the taxpayers about $1 million apiece, but none of it will come out from Trump's pocket. Quite the opposite, in fact. since he reported owning stock in Raytheon when he began his run for the White House, and there's no report that he's divested from it. Whether he owns an interest in the company that makes the GBU-4, so-called MOAB, Massive Ordnance Air Blast, or Mother of All Bombs, depending on who you ask, that was dropped in Afghanistan near the Pakistan border on April 13th, ostensibly targeting ISIS fighters hiding in tunnels, has not been reported, nor what its use had actually accomplished. Moreover, why was ISIS being targeted in Afghanistan, where the fighting against the U.S.-backed government and U.S.-trained army is being carried out almost exclusively by the Taliban? Well, the original intention of the 21,000-pound bomb was to act as a non-nuclear deterrent against Saddam Hussein. The goal is to have the pressure be so great that Saddam cooperates, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld said in a 2003 interview. Short of that, he said, an unwillingness to cooperate, the goal is to have the capabilities of the coalition so clear and so obvious that there is an enormous disincentive for the Iraqi military to fight against the coalition, end quote. Well, during testing, the weapon reportedly created a mushroom cloud that could be seen 20 miles away from the blast. Each MOAB cost around $16 million, according to a military information website. 20 of these bombs have reportedly been made at a cost to the taxpayers of $314 million. In 2008, an article at the Eglin Air Force Base newsletter where the bomb was tested asked, quote, "What's worse than unleashing on society the wrath of the largest non-nuclear bomb yet to be made? Letting the world know it's out there and ready to be used any moment," end quote. That's apparently what Trump has been demonstrating, and from the positive support he's received from liberals in the U.S. media and the political illiterates who haven't the faintest idea what our war is about, his willingness to use force is what has now made him presidential. Good quotes around that. Even when he makes a fool of himself, as he's dangerous, as he proved when he announced that a U.S. naval armada was heading toward the waters off North Korea, when in fact they were steaming in the opposite direction. Well, they quickly turned around, and on Monday, the Japanese government announced that its navy is sending two destroyers to join the American armada as it steams toward the Korean Peninsula. Washington, incidentally, sent the USS Carl Vinson, initially sent the USS Carl Vinson group to the region as a symbol of American strength to show Kim Jong-un how tough we are, what is in store for his country if it continues to defy the U.S. by testing ballistic missiles or nuclear warheads. North Korea immediately responded to the military mobilization, according to Reuters, citing a North Korea state newspaper that said, quote, "The United States should not run amok and should consider carefully any catastrophic consequence from its foolish military provocative act. What's only laid for aggression is dead bodies," end quote. President Trump had earlier sent his Vice President Mike Pence to the region, hoping to scare the pants off Kim Jong-un. Speaking from the deck of an aircraft carrier, Pence told the 2,500 sailors obliged to hear him at Tokyo's U.S. Yokosuka Naval Base that, quote, "United States of America will always seek peace, but under President Trump, the shield stands guard and the sword stands ready," end quote. It seems that Trump is not the only clown in Washington. A week ago Monday, Pence visited the Demilitarized Zone, the DMZ, that divides North and South Korea. The Washington Post reported that although Pence wasn't supposed to step outside, he did anyway. Why? So North Koreans could get a load of him displaying his tough jaw in their direction. Seriously. "I thought it was important that we went outside," Pence said, according to the Washington Post. "I thought it was important that people on the other side of the DMZ see our resolve in my face." End quote. That remark raised more than a few laughs on Saturday's NPR news quiz, "Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me." The situation, however, is deadly serious, as indicated by a report that the entire Senate will be briefed on it this morning by War Secretary Jim Mattis, the Butcher of Fallujah, and Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, and others at the White House this morning. The Lawyers Committee for Nuclear Policy has sent out a notice urging people to call your senators and urge them to demand a peaceful resolution of this extremely dangerous confrontation. In the prisons of Israel, in the meantime, over 1,000 Palestinian prisoners who, according to international law, shouldn't have been there in the first place, went on a hunger strike, led by Marwan Barghouti, considered by some to be his people's Nelson Mandela. Why they shouldn't be in those prisons is made quite clear by the international law. It strictly forbids an occupying country, in this instance Israel, from imprisoning inhabitants of the land they are occupying in its prisons. But of course, Israel states pays no attention to international laws, and tragically for its victims, like America's many more, neither is it ever called to account. What outraged some Israelis, but incredibly, the New York Times afforded space on its op-ed page to an essay by Barghouti explaining why he and his fellow prisoners had initiated the hunger strike. From Israel's Hadarim prison on August 16th, where he had been moved immediately when the strike began, Barghouti wrote, quote, "Having spent the last 15 years in an Israeli prison, I have been both a witness to and a victim of Israel's illegal system of mass arbitrary arrests and ill treatment of Palestinian prisoners. After exhausting all the other options, I decided there was no choice but to resist these abuses by going on a hunger strike. Some 1,000 Palestinians," he wrote, "1,000 Palestinian prisoners have decided to take part in this hunger strike, which begins today. The day we observe here is Prisoners' Day. Hunger striking is the most peaceful form of resistance available. It inflicts pain solely on those who participate and on their loved ones in the hopes that their empty stomachs and their sacrifice will help them send the message and resonate beyond the confines of their dark cells. Decades of experience have proved that Israel's inhumane system of colonial and military occupation aims to break the spirit of prisoners and the nation to which they belong by inflicting suffering on their bodies, separating them from their families and communities, using humiliating measures to compel subjugation. In spite of such treatment, we will not surrender to it." End quote. That was how Palestinian political prisoner Marwan Barghouti began his article in the New York Times, where it can still be found online. Barghouti, first jailed when he was 15, is currently serving 5 life terms in Hadarim prison for crimes he was alleged to have been responsible for during the Second Intifada that lasted from 2000 to 2004. The paper now offers an apology for not having described his alleged crimes and not identifying Barghouti as a terrorist, the appellation that Israel applies to any Palestinian that offers more than token resistance to its illegal occupation of their homeland. Israel's sadistic treatment of Palestinians, about which I previously commented, was on full display outside of the Ofer prison, where most of the Palestinian striking prisoners are being held. The Brooklyn-based Jewish Press, the leading publication for ultra-Orthodox Jews, cheerfully reported that, quote, "starting at 12 p.m. today, Thursday, April 20th, 2017, young National Union Ikud Lumai activists are hosting a free barbecue outside the Ofer prison on Route 443 just outside of Jerusalem. Grilling the food just outside the prison walls," their correspondent reported. "The delicious smell wafts through the prison, and their intention is to taunt the convicted PA terrorists who are hunger striking to receive 5-star accommodations and privileges," end quote. The article, continuing in the same vein, was accompanied by photos of what appeared to be shish kebab cooking on outdoor barbecue grills. It should be mentioned that the same newspaper, before it went online, celebrated the murder of 29 Palestinians and the wounding of 125 more by a Brooklyn-born doctor, Baruch Goldstein, on February 25, 1994, while they were bent in prayer at the Cave of the Patriarchs in occupied Hebron. By no accident, it was the Jewish holiday of Purim, which venerates another massacre, this one of Persians in biblical times. News of that would probably not be regarded as self-defense by the 90 U.S. senators, would probably be regarded as self-defense by the 90 U.S. senators and the more than 300 members of the House who have signed letters scripted by Israel's U.S. lobby, AIPAC, to the new U.N. Secretary General Antonio Guterres, calling on him to have U.N. institutions treat Israel more fairly. It is just one of scores of such letters that have been written on Israel's behalf for almost a half century by our Israeli preoccupied Congress. And as far as I can tell, no other country has been blessed with such bipartisan U.S. support. I am pleased to let you know that neither Dianne Feinstein nor Jared Huffman are among the signatures, nor is Bernie Sanders. Sorry, I can't say the same for our new Senator Kamala Harris or Elizabeth Warren, who has shown the ability to get on her knees for AIPAC in Israel as quickly as any of her colleagues. If that wasn't Congress's, if that wasn't Congress's subservience to Israel, if that wasn't already disgusting beyond words, two Republican House members, Florida's Ron DeSantis and Ohio's Bill Johnson, plan to launch the Congressional Israel Victory Caucus, CIVC, tomorrow at 9 a.m. The caucus goal is to introduce a new U.S. approach to Israel-Palestinian relations. Johnson notes that, quote, Israel is America's closest ally in the Middle East, and the community of nations must accept that Israel has the right to exist, period. That is not negotiable now nor ever. According to the press release put out by the Middle East Forum, a far-right pro-Israel nonprofit, the Congressional Israel Victory Caucus aims to focus on this precept and to better inform our colleagues in Congress about daily life in Israel and the present-day conflict, end quote. It probably wouldn't make any difference if they or the senators who have been conditioned to bow down to Israel were informed that the hated ISIS apologized to Israel for attacking its soldiers on the Golan Heights, as the Times of Israel reported on Monday. According to the paper, quote, former Defense Minister Moshe Yaalon on Saturday said the Islamic State terrorist group in the Syrian Golan Heights, quote, unquote, apologized for attacking an Israeli unit. There was one case recently where Daesh opened fire and apologized, Yaalon said, using the terror group's Arabic nickname. That's not their nickname, that is their name, in fact. This was an apparent reference to a clash that took place near the Syrian border last November, noted the paper, in which IDF troops exchanged fire with members of the Islamic State affiliate. After a brief gun battle, the Israeli military attacked the terrorist group with airstrikes and tank fire, killing four of them, end quote. Israel has made no secret of its providing medical aid and hospital care for any fighter wounded by in battle against the Syrian government, regardless of which organization they represent. While Prime Minister President Benjamin Netanyahu has stated on more than one occasion that Iran is a greater threat to Israel and the world than is ISIS. But that is something like this story that you won't hear on Fox News, MSNBC, or NPR. Nor are you likely to hear anywhere else that on March 30th, a federal judge in the Washington District Circuit, Tanya Shutkin, found it, quote, neither logical nor plausible for the CIA to claim it had no intelligence budget data showing what it provided Israel between 1990 and 2015, which was the subject of a Freedom of Information request by Grant Smith, director of IRMEP, the Institute for Research Middle East Policy, who has been a frequent guest on this program. On August 5, 2015, Smith noted, President Obama quantified the possible dollar value of such intelligence aid in a speech at American University claiming, quote, due to American military and intelligence assistance, which my administration has provided at unprecedented levels, Israel can defend itself against any conventional danger, end quote. At a minimum, Smith calculates, that additional intelligence aid amounted to at least $1.9 billion annually on top of the $3 billion-plus Israel was already receiving. Judge Shukin ordered the Department of Justice Legal Counsel in response to her order by April 24th. But when the Justice Department lawyer did instead was to ask the judge for a reconsideration of the case and for a summary dismissal to which Smith has filed his objections. I'll have more in this case on May 24th when Grant Smith will again be my guest and we will be speaking about the state of U.S.-Israel relations in the Trump administration. This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening. Thank you.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. This week we feature the voice of Palestinian historian Joseph Massad, who spoke at Harvard University during Anti-Apartheid Week as part of a series of events sponsored by the Harvard-Palestine Solidarity Committee. Joseph Massad is professor of modern Arab politics and intellectual history at Columbia University.
Thank you very much, Omar, and I'm honored to be here. Thank you for inviting me to campus on this important events. Israel Apartheid Week has been an important event at many universities across the U.S., Europe, and Canada, and I think it's increasingly spreading, including, I think, in Australia more recently as well. Is the microphone working well? All right. 2 months ago, and upon receiving Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at the White House, President Donald Trump became the first U.S. president to speak of two possible futures for Palestine. One as a mini-state alongside Israel, and the other as one state subsumed within Israel. His predecessor, the most pro-Israeli and anti-Palestinian U.S. president since 1948, Barack Obama, who claimed to support the two-state solution, had demanded that all Arabs and Palestinians, and I quote, recognize Israel as a Jewish state, unquote, and threatened them with dire consequences if they continued to, quote, delegitimize it. What do Trump and Obama mean by one state and two states? And what did Obama mean by, quote, recognizing Israel as a Jewish state? Let me recap some of the basic history of these terms within the Zionist movement and in international diplomatic circles in order to clarify what is at stake in them today. The fantasy that frames Zionism's colonial vision of the past and future of Palestine is that of a purely Jewish land, uncontaminated by non-Jews. Zionism fantasizes Palestine's ancient past as that of a land inhabited exclusively by the ancient Hebrews, and fantasizes a future where Palestine will be again exclusively inhabited by Jews, who Zionism claims are the direct descendants of the Hebrews. In this sense, all Zionism thinks it is doing is setting the world right again by promising a future that will restore what once was. I will revisit in the following lecture how these two fantasies have been articulated over the last century and a quarter in political life. Since its inception, Zionism's fictional narratives about Palestine's past borrowed from biblical narratives that had been long adopted by European converts to Judaism and Christianity, wherein, in the doctored Zionist version, the Hebrews are presented as the only ancient inhabitants of the land, and the extent to which the Canaanites are mentioned at all is as interlopers to be vanquished by the Hebrews. European converts to Judaism and Christianity insisted, at least since the Crusades, that whereas the European converts to Christianity were not descendants of the ancient Palestinian Christians and had no ethnic connection to them, European converts to Judaism were indeed descendants of the ancient Palestinian Hebrews. However, in contrast to European converts to Judaism, who made no claims to the land, European converts to Christianity insisted that they were connected to Palestine as the land of Christ and sought to invade it and take it over, a crusading project that succeeded for about two centuries before they were driven out by Salah ad-Din's forces. The memory of that last attempt remains strong in the minds of modern European colonists. When the French invaded Syria in 1918, the French general, Gouraud, stood by Saladin's grave and announced, "Saladin, nous voilà," or "Saladin, we have returned." While Protestant Zionism sought to expel European Jews to Palestine since the 16th century, with the majority of Jews resisting this call to expel them, it was not until the 19th century that enough European Jews began to insist that not only were they the descendants of the ancient Hebrews, but that they, like European Christians before them, were also heirs to the land of Palestine to which they wanted to return. These would be the principles on which the Zionist movement based itself to embark on the colonization of Palestine. Zionism's aim to colonize Palestine and establish a Jewish state was initially articulated through two tracks, a realist one and a science fictional one. The first was expressed in Theodore Herzl's 1896 pamphlet, The State of the Jews, Der Judenstaat, and in his diaries, where he also jotted down a lot of his plans for the colonization of the country, while the second was expressed in his 1902 science fiction novel titled Altneuland, or Old New Land. If the past of Palestine for European converts to Christianity and Judaism was a fictionalized biblical past cleansed of and delinked from the actual inhabitants of the land, Zionism proposed a science fiction future for the country, which it sought to realize over the next decades. Part of the realist plan was to ignore the Palestinian inhabitants, who are not mentioned except once in Herzl's The State of the Jews, and only in a cursory fashion. While listing Palestine and Argentina as possible sites for the establishment of the State of the Jews, Herzl worried that, quote, in both countries, important experiments in colonization have been made, though on the mistaken principle of a gradual infiltration of Jews. An infiltration is bound to end badly. It continues, he tells us, till the inevitable moment when the native population feels itself threatened and forced the government to stop a further influx of Jews. Immigration is therefore futile unless we have the sovereign right to continue such immigration, unquote. This cautionary warning informed the strategy that the Zionist movement followed in order to obtain the 1917 Balfour Declaration from the British government, whose sovereignty would guarantee continuous colonization. In the meantime, Zionism began to advertise its project with the slogan, "A land without a people, for a people without a land." To establish the right of continuous colonization of Palestine, the Balfour Declaration, celebrating its centennial this year, ensured that the native inhabitants' resistance to Jewish colonization would be suppressed as the British government ensured and sponsored its continuation. Balfour committed the British government to establish in Palestine a national home for the Jewish people and warned against prejudicing the rights of non-Jews in Palestine, which was the only reference to the entirety of the Palestinian native population. Here we see that whereas Zionism was able to write the native inhabitants of Palestine out of the past and future of the country, it was also actively seeking to write them out of the present of the country, while at the same time devising strategies to neutralize their resistance to Jewish colonization. This is not to say that Zionism thought that the current Palestinian inhabitants of the land were not in fact the descendants of the ancient Hebrews. On the contrary, Zionist leaders made constant declarations up to the late 1920s about this most interesting realization. David Ben-Gurion had famously written, as had other Zionist leaders, including Yitzhak Ben-Zvi, that, quote, In spite of much intermixing, the majority of the Palestinian peasants in Western Palestine are unified in their external appearance, and in their origin and in their veins, without a doubt, flows much Jewish blood. From the Jewish peasants, who in the days of the persecutions and terrible oppression had renounced their tradition and their people in order to maintain their attachment and loyalty to the land of the Jews. Unquote. This was, of course, a most threatening realization, as it meant that Zionism's goal was for European converts to Judaism to colonize Palestine and expel those who Zionism itself recognized as the actual descendants of the ancient Hebrews. Indeed, Zionism, as Edward Said had explicated 4 decades ago, went further in its arguments by claiming that European converts to Judaism were the actual natives of Palestine who were away for a mere 2 millennia. While the Palestine natives were no more than colonists who had taken over this ancient Jewish land. This is how Said put it. I quote him, "The colonization of Palestine always proceeded as a fact of repetition. The Jews were not supplanting, destroying, breaking up a native society. That society itself was the oddity that had broken the pattern of a 60-year Jewish sovereignty over Palestine, which had lapsed for 2 millennia. Unquote. Mind you, this is not only the stuff of early Zionist propaganda, but part of ongoing Israeli propaganda today. A few weeks ago, and during his joint press conference with President Trump, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu complained bitterly about the refusal of the Palestinian natives to accept this fictional colonial version of history. He declared that the Palestinians, and I quote, "The Palestinians even deny, Mr. President, our historical connection to our homeland. And I suppose you have to ask yourself, why are Jews called Jews? Well, the Chinese are called Chinese because they come from China. The Japanese are called Japanese because they come from Japan. Well, Jews are called Jews because they come from Judea. This is our ancestral homeland. Jews are not foreign colonialists in Judea. So unfortunately, the Palestinians not only deny the past, they also poison the present." Unquote. Whereas biblical Christian archaeology and later Zionist archaeology began to excavate the land to find Jewish traces from the past of Palestine, over a century and a half of such excavations have failed to produce a single major Hebrew monument on the scale left by the ancient Palestinian Christians and Muslims. Still, Israeli archaeology, while bulldozing much of these Palestinian traces underground, is continuing its search for the so-called second Jewish temple under Al-Aqsa Mosque, whose very structural integrity it has weakened in its desperate search for proof. As if whatever it could find would prove at all that European converts to Judaism have a right to the land of the Palestinians. However, as the factual presence of the native Palestinians could no longer be denied after World War I, the plan was to reduce their numbers as much as possible. The 1925 British imposed nationality law naturalized a large number of foreign Jews who had just arrived in the country by virtue of the British allowing them to come in, and it denationalized upwards of 40,000 Palestinians. The Zionists were able to persuade the British not to grant the Palestinians self-determination or a government structure, as the British had done in their other mandated territories in the Middle East, like in Jordan and Iraq, for example. Taking Herzl's caution to heart, the head of the World Zionist Organization, Chaim Weizmann, wrote in 1930 to the British Undersecretary of State, John Schottberg, expressing his opposition to Palestinian self-determination while supporting it for world Jewry, affirming that, quote, "The rights that the Jewish people has been adjudged in Palestine by the British mandate do not depend on the consent and cannot be subject to the will of the majority of Palestine's present inhabitants." Unquote. Indeed, Weizmann was clear that when the British promised the Zionists a national home in Palestine, and I quote him, "the agreement of the Palestinian Arabs was not asked. The reason for why Palestinian consent was of no import," he added, "was on account of the uniqueness of the Jewish connection to Palestine." He further claimed that as Arabs were being granted self-determination in neighboring states like Iraq, they could not be allowed to stand in the way of Jewish colonial aspirations in Palestine. As for the Palestinians themselves, and I quote him now, they could not be considered as owning the country in the sense in which the inhabitants of Iraq or Egypt possess their respective countries. To grant themselves determination or self-government or a legislative assembly, he added, would be to assign the country to its present inhabitants. And to cancel in an underhanded manner the Balfour Declaration's commitment to a Jewish national home. Unquote. Realizing that any attempt to establish democratic rule and self-determination for the Palestinians would block Zionist colonization, the Zionist leadership began to make different plans to expel them en masse and bring about a future Palestine that was emptied of its Palestinian natives. This Herzl had already suggested in his diaries, but no coherent plan had been prepared yet. Weizmann sought to denationalize the Palestinians initially by claiming that they were not attached to their country. In 1918, he wrote to Lord Balfour explaining, and I quote, that the Arabs, who are superficially clever and quick-witted, worship one thing only, power and success. And he added that the British should know, quote, the treacherous nature of the Arabs, unquote. Of the Palestinian people, he added, quote, the fellah is at least four centuries behind the times, and the effendi is dishonest, uneducated, greedy, and as unpatriotic as he is inefficient, unquote. All this would be in preparation for the expulsion of the Palestinians. One of the many plans that came to be considered was one that was the brainchild of American Jewish Zionist millionaire Edward Norman, who came up with the idea of expelling the Palestinians to Iraq in 1934. Weizmann, along with the future Israeli prime ministers David Ben-Gurion and Moshe Shevtok, later Moshe Sharet, paid serious attention to Norman's plan in 1939 and began to promote it. In February 1941, in the middle of World War II, Weizmann became more open about the plan to expel 1 million Palestinians to Iraq and replace them, as per Weizmann's suggestion, with 5 million Polish and other European Jewish colonists. On one occasion, he told his plans to the Soviet ambassador in London, Ivan Maisky, of Jewish background himself, in the hope of obtaining Soviet support. When Maisky expressed surprise about how 5 million Jews would fit in an area on which only 1 million Palestinians live, Weizmann replied with a racist argument not unlike the ones used against the Jews of Europe during that same period. We're speaking here of 1941. Namely, as Weizmann put it, the Palestinians' laziness and primitivism turn a flourishing garden into a desert. Give me the land occupied by 1 million Arabs, and I will easily settle 5 times that number of Jews on it. Unquote. This was the state of Zionist thinking when, after the war, the United Nations began to discuss what it called the Palestine problem. And finally, under pressure from the U.S. and the Soviets, the General Assembly adopted the partition plan of 29th November 1947. Whereas the recent Jewish colonists, who constituted 30% of the population, the majority of whom had just arrived in the country in the previous 2 decades under British tutelage, and who owned, according to Zionist records, a mere 6.6% of the land, were granted upwards of 55% of the territory of Palestine by the partition plan. The Palestinian natives who lived on the land for millennia and who constituted 70% of the population and owned the majority of the land were granted about 45% of the country. This was the first international document that called for the establishment of a Jewish state in contrast with a national home for Jews. Given the insistence today by Israel's leadership that the Palestinians must recognize Israel as a Jewish state, and the threats issued by President Obama to the Palestinians to do so, it behooves us to go back to the UN plan and to find out what the term or the expression a Jewish state meant for the authors of the document. The UN partition plan was a non-binding proposal that was never ratified or adopted by the Security Council, and therefore never acquired legal standing as UN regulations require. Although, as far as the Palestinian people are concerned, the UN had no right at any rate to partition what was not theirs to partition, much less to do so without the consultation of the Palestinian natives themselves, thus denying them the right of self-determination. Nonetheless, it is important to consider what the plan meant by Jewish state and Arab state, due to the fact that the Israeli government uses this document as authorizing its very establishment and its subsequent policies. For the Zionist movement and Israel to rely on the plan for the establishment of an exclusively Jewish state that was emptied of Arabs, it would need to establish if the plan proposed that the two states resulting from partition be exclusively Jewish and Arab demographically, or that their laws should grant rights to Jews or Arabs differentially and discriminate against non-Jews or non-Arabs. Expectedly, this was not the case. Even though Israel proceeded to institute more than 50 racially and religiously discriminatory laws against its Palestinian Arab citizens and set on to expropriate the large majority of lands in the country owned by Palestinian Arabs, the partition plan never proposed or authorized it to do so. The plan rather stated clearly, and I quote, "No discrimination of any kind shall be made between the inhabitants on the ground of race, religion, language, or sex." This is in Chapter 2, Article 2 of the Partition Plan. And it added that, quote, "No expropriation of land owned by an Arab in the Jewish state or by a Jew in the Arab state shall be allowed except for public purposes. In all cases of expropriation, full compensation as fixed by the Supreme Court shall be said previous to dispossession," unquote. However, Zionism's plan for the future of Palestine as an exclusively Jewish state set in motion the necessity of expelling the Palestinians. When the Israeli so-called Declaration of Independence, its official name, of course, is the Declaration of the Establishment of the State of Israel. It's only called Declaration of Independence in vernacular sort of parlance, even though, in fact, a proposal had been suggested initially to call a Declaration of Independence, the Israeli government refused. Nonetheless, when the Israeli Declaration of Independence was issued on May 14, 1948, the Zionist forces had already expelled about 400,000 Palestinians from their lands, and they would expel another 350,000 in the coming months. From this it follows clearly that not only is Israel's claim to establish a Jewish state that established demographic majority by ethnic cleansing was not authorized by the partition plan, but neither was its claim to be a Jewish state in the sense of a state that privileges Jewish citizens over non-Jewish citizens legally and institutionally. The irony of the matter is that the proposed partition plan on which Israel bases its establishment initially envisioned a Jewish state with an Arab demographic majority, which it later modified slightly to include only 45% Arab population and 55% Jews. Indeed, as Palestine was divided into 16 districts by the partition plan, 9 of which were located in the proposed Jewish state, Palestinian Arabs were a majority in 8 of the 9 districts that would constitute this Jewish state. Nowhere does the partition plan's use of the term Jewish state authorize ethnic cleansing or the colonization of one ethnic group of the confiscated lands of another. Especially as the plan envisioned Arabs in the Jewish state to be a perpetual large minority, and thus stipulated the rights that should be accorded to minorities in each state. But the fact that Arabs were a large minority and could conceivably within a few years have overtaken the Jewish population inside the Jewish state remained uncontemplated by the plan. For example, the plan did not consider the consequences of the fact that if Jewish nationalism could define the Jew, or would define the Jewish state, how then could it accommodate almost half its population who had a different notion of nationalism and whom it excludes from its state nationalism a priori? And were the Palestinian Arabs in the Jewish state not adherents to Palestinian nationalism, they could not become, even if they so wished, Jewish nationalists, as they are excluded from Jewish nationalism ipso facto, as unlike Palestinian Arab nationalism, the basis of which are land and language, are not religion or race, Jewishness can only be acquired religiously, but not ethnically or racially. How then could the Jewish state not discriminate against its own Palestinian Arab citizens? This demographic situation would not have been a problem for the Palestinian Arab state envisioned by the partition plan, not only because of its easier conditions for membership in the nation, but more so as the partition plan envisioned that the Arab state would have a mere 1.36% Jewish population. Essentially, both states were going to have a Palestinian majority. The future of Palestine forecast by the partition plan, therefore, was of two states, one with almost 99% of the natives of Palestine and another with 45% of the natives of the country and 55% of the Jewish colonists. A lot of gerrymandering had to actually take place once they realized initially that the initial borders of the Jewish state had a majority of Palestinians, so they had to actually go in and make sure gerrymander the areas to produce a 45% minority of Palestinians in the Jewish state. This future was rejected by the natives as well as by the colonists. Israel set out to invade and take all the territory assigned to the Jewish state and over half the territory assigned to the Arab state and expelled 90% of the Palestinian natives in the 78% of the country that it took over by the force of arms. Here it is important to stress that for the architects of the partition plan, a Jewish state meant a state ruled by Jewish nationalists who adhered to Zionism, but whose population is almost half Palestinian Arabs, whose lands cannot be confiscated for Jewish colonization, and who would have equal rights to Jews and not suffer any racial or religious discrimination. For Israel, the meaning of a Jewish state is very different, as it means the right to expel the majority of the native Palestinian population, a refusal to repatriate them, the confiscation of their land for the exclusive colonization of Jews, and the enactment of discriminatory laws against those Palestinians who remained in the country. When Israel insists today that the Palestinian Authority and other Arab states recognize it as a Jewish state, they do not mean that they should recognize its Jewishness in the way the partition plan envisioned, but rather in the way Israel understands and exercises this definition on the ground. It is important to note in this regard that it remains unclear which meaning of Jewish President Obama has in mind when he demands that Arabs and Palestinians must recognize Israel as a Jewish state. The partition plan's sense or Israel's? I should mention here that President George W. Bush was the only other U.S. president aside from Obama who made a similar demand since 1948. Today, as the number of Jews under Israeli jurisdiction has again diminished to less than 50% of the population, including in Israel proper, East Jerusalem, the West Bank, and in besieged Gaza, currently at about 6.5 million Jews and 6.5 million Palestinians, even if about 1 million of the Jewish citizens whom Israel counts as part of its population actually live in the U.S. and other countries while retaining Israeli nationality. Israeli leaders constantly speak of the so-called demographic bomb that Palestinians constitute to the Jewish state and have been devising plans to expel the more than 1.75 million Palestinian citizens of Israel to the Bantustans of the West Bank, which they claim can become a state without any state power, as Prime Minister Netanyahu recently proposed to the Australian Prime Minister. Netanyahu's vision of a future Palestine is not that different from the vision of early Zionists, in fairness to him. Sometimes he is produced as somehow more extreme than other Israeli leaders. He's not. In the 1930s, Chaim Weizmann was keen on denying Palestinian self-determination, but he agreed that the Zionists would have no problem with the Palestinians being given self-governing powers over, and I quote, Arab education, hospitals, religious and cultural institutions for the Muslim and Christian communities, etc., but not over the future of their country or over the Jewish colonial settlers. In the 1978 Camp David Accords that Israel signed with Anwar Sadat's Egypt, Menachem Begin also expressed his vision of a future Palestine where the Palestinians would have the same kind of what he called autonomy envisioned for them by Weizmann. In line with this, while in Australia a few weeks ago, Netanyahu insisted that Israel could only accept a Palestinian state over which, quote, Israel has the overriding security control of all the territories, he repeats, all the territories. Other than that, I want the Palestinians to be able to govern themselves and to have all the freedoms to do so, but not the freedom to destroy the Jewish state, unquote. The alternative to this scenario, as far as Israeli leaders are concerned, is the fate that befell other European colonial settlers in Algeria, in Kenya, and Rhodesia. France, for example, was forced to accede to Algerian demands for an end to settler colonialism, but not before it guaranteed the property rights of all the European colonial settlers in Algeria through the Evian Accords of March 1962. The Pieds Noirs, or the French colonial settlers, however, refused to stay in Algeria, knowing that their racial privileges would be revoked, even if their colonial property was going to be preserved and guaranteed. They opted to repatriate back to France. In Kenya, and the other British settler colony close to Palestine, and incidentally one that also had been promised to Theodore Herzl in the beginning of the century as a possible site to set up the Jewish colonial settlement, the Lancaster House Conferences of 1960 to 1963 set the conditions for the independence of the country following the Mau Mau War of Liberation, making sure to preserve white colonial settler property, even if the majority of the white settlers also opted to leave, but not before they were generously compensated for the colonially acquired property by World Bank and British subsidies on a willing buyer, willing seller basis. In Rhodesia, less threatened by imminent revolution by the indigenous population, the white colonial settlers issued in 1965 the Unilateral Declaration of Independence, or UDI. They did so after the British gave them much support, pushing for the deferral of majority rule in their country for decades to come, just like the US tries to do in the case of Israel. Indeed, the 1961 constitution that Britain devised for Rhodesia for that purpose was supported by a majority of the white colonists, whose ambition, however, remained a formula that would render white supremacist colonial rule in the country permanent, which was what they sought to achieve with UDI, or the Unilateral Declaration of Independence. As UDI was issued in the middle of the hegemony of the new anti-colonial discourse derived from the Bandung Conference in 1955 and decolonization, the British and other Western powers had no choice under pressure from the recently decolonized countries in Africa and Asia, but to impose sanctions at the United Nations, which did not become mandatory, however, until 1968, by which time the white Rhodesians had withdrawn all their funds from the United Kingdom and transferred them to apartheid South Africa before they could be frozen. By the late 70s, upon the imminent defeat of the white colonists, the British government, through the Lancaster House Agreement of 1979, which facilitated the independence of Zimbabwe, undertook to safeguard all the settlers' colonially acquired land. The agreement tied the hands of the post-independence government of Zimbabwe, led by the Zimbabwe African National Union, Patriotic Front, ZANU, from initiating land reform in the country, i.e. expropriating the lands of the white colonial settlers, for a decade after independence, while the British government, as well as the US government under Jimmy Carter, provided funds to compensate white colonists, again on a willing seller, willing buyer basis, ensuring that colonial white property rights would be preserved for the white colonists and would continue to be denied to Zimbabwe's native black population. The situation would end up holding for two decades until 2000, when the Mugabe government, under popular pressure by poor black farmers, initiated a forced takeover of white-owned farms without compensation, amid much corruption within the Mugabe government, many of whose cronies would take over many of these lands instead of redistributing them to poor farmers. The Western response to this violation of the right of conquest of white settlers was swift. Sanctions were immediately imposed on Zimbabwe by the US, the UK, and the European Union, with a major media campaign against Zimbabwe since then. Still, this has not restored white colonial privileges in Zimbabwe. South African whites fared better when they negotiated maintaining their colonial economic power for surrendering white supremacist political power in 1994. None of these, however, are viable options for the Jewish colonists of Palestine, who insist that unlike all these settler colonies before them, they shall persist through insisting, and the white settler world especially, along with them, on safeguarding their colonial and racial privileges in the name of Jewish exceptionalism. It seems from the above that the imagined future of Palestine, according to what these various formulas are, is as follows. One state for the Israeli leadership means a Jewish state with a battery of racist laws against all non-Jews and the possible expulsion of non-Jews, as many in Israel advocate, including over 50% of Israeli Jews polled by Israeli pollsters. Two states means that Israel remain a Jewish racist state that controls all the Palestinian territories, but that the Palestinian Authority, which insists on helping Israel implement its vision of the future, can set policy for Palestinian hospitals, education, and religious and cultural institutions, provided that the Palestinian educational system and the cultural institutions recognize Israel or Israel's right to be a Jewish state. As for what it means for Israel to be a Jewish state, again, it means that Israel has the right to enact a battery of racist laws to ensure the Jewish character of the state. Having instituted its fictional version of Palestine's past in international politics, and having full control over Palestine's present as an outcome of international political support, the only realist future that Israel's leaders plan for Palestine is an exact replica of the present. It does not matter if it is one state or two, as the difference is slight and not of much consequence. Israeli leaders, however, still imagine and wish for a science fictional future of a Jewish state that is free of all non-Jews, and in that they are not unlike, you know, American white supremacists who wish for a whites-only U.S. How Israeli leaders will bring this about into reality remains to be seen. In the meantime, Israel and its U.S. sponsor understand very well that the crux of the matter is Israel's colonial and racist character, which is why they insist that all possible futures for Palestine must ensure Israel's colonial and racist privileges. As the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement has become one of the principal weapons in the Palestinian arsenal against this kind of a future, efforts are afoot to criminalize it in the U.S., as candidate Hillary Clinton had hoped to do had she won the elections. Netanyahu is not off the mark, however, when he insisted recently that the question of Jewish colonies in East Jerusalem and in the West Bank is, quote, overblown. He declared, and I quote him, "It is an issue, but not the issue. The core of the conflict between us and the Palestinians is their persistent refusal to recognize a Jewish state in any boundary," unquote, by which he means a Jewish state with racist laws against non-Jews established on stolen Palestinian lands. The Palestinian BDS National Committee and the international BDS movement and their supporters are working toward another future, one where Jews and Palestinians would live in a decolonized one state, or two, or three, with equal rights and free from racist laws. To some, this may seem like a science fictional future, but not to the Israeli and U.S. governments that are doing everything in their power to prevent its emergence as a real and realist future. Thank you.
You have been listening to an address by Columbia University professor Joseph Massad, delivered at Harvard University. This was followed by a robust question and answer period that, due to lack of time, will not allow us to broadcast in full, but we do want to add one question which we think important to include. It is from a student concerned that should there be some kind of reversal of fortune, should the walls come down in Israel and 5 to 6 million Palestinian refugees return to inhabit historic Palestine, and should Fatah and or Hamas come to power, what would happen to the Jewish population? Here is the question and the answer.
Please.
Yeah. So I want to understand the best case scenario of BDS. Let's say the separation wall falls down, 5 to 6 million Palestinian refugees reinstated within Israel, abolishing it as the Jewish state the way Israel planned. So the Palestinian leadership then, by democracy, let's say, decides what to do with the Jewish minority, And it's split between Fatah, who are talking about mass expulsion of the Jews, and Hamas, who are talking about mass extermination of the Jews. And if I look at the other minorities in the Middle East, the ethnic cleansing of the Christians, and realizing that the atrocity and hatred towards the Jews, especially among the Palestinian refugees and residents, is even worse. How worried should I be about my family in Israel? My parents, my brother and sister in Israel, and my nephews and nieces, my friends and nephews. If that happens.
Well, I mean, I'm not sure how worried you should be, but I can tell you, I mean, there are several problems with what you've proposed because a lot of it is not based on actual fact. I mean, Fatah and the PLO have called on accepting all Jews in Israel since as early as 1973. This is not a new position for Fatah. Hamas has negotiated with Israel since the 1980s and early 90s with the Yitzhak Rabin government, spoke about reaching an agreement where it would accept the borders of 1967 and negotiate with Israel. In fact, Hamas just issued a document 2 weeks ago reasserting for the first time formally that, as Fatah had done before, that it would accept setting a Palestinian government on the 1967 borders. BDS, of course, does not support that, because even if you have a Palestinian state, assuming Israel would ever allow an actual Palestinian independent state in the West Bank and Gaza, that means Israel's racist character and racist nature would continue to be. I don't think any country should be allowed to be racist and have 50 racist laws on the books. So I think one stater or two stater. I mean, I think if Israel and those who want two states want two states, that's fine. But both states should have to be democratic and not racist. So even if you have a state in the West Bank and Gaza for the native Palestinians of the West Bank and Gaza, this does not do away with the Palestinians who are expelled from Israel proper, or those who live in Israel and who continue to be victims of these 50 laws. Now, the Palestinians have proposed since 1974 that, in fact, what they sought, at least the PLO did, was a secular democratic state where everybody is equal, whereas, of course, Israel and the Jewish leadership in Israel has always promised a discriminatory, racist country as the only possible future. So these are very different proposals and oppositional. One is a racist, supremacist approach. The other one is a democratic one. You're perhaps concerned about Palestinians not liking Israelis because of all the horrific massacres and violence they've visited on them since the 1880s, but especially since 1948. You are right. They don't. But no more, no less than, of course, whites in South Africa blacks in South Africa did not like whites, or blacks in the U.S., in the southern U.S. did not like white people. We've seen, however, integration. We haven't seen major massacres, not even in Zimbabwe or in Kenya, of any such thing. On the contrary, I think increasingly it seems to me the problem is not Palestinian hatred of Jews. It's actually given the numbers of casualties, and that Israel has killed about 100,000 people since 1948, the majority of whom were Palestinians, but equally, of course, neighboring Arabs, but between all the wars, the discrepancy in the numbers between a colonizing power that kills natives versus native resistance is great. And I think one should worry about would the Jewish population get adjusted to living in a democratic, decolonized country without racial and colonial privileges? Would they accept equality or not? The Palestinians have been proposing equality, and therefore the onus is on the majority of the Jewish population in Israel, who continues to be committed to a racialist and colonialist structure of differentiation between them and others based on Jewish exceptionalism. On the question of so-called ethnic cleansing of Christians, first of all, Christians are not an ethnicity in the Arab world. They're Arabs, and therefore, assuming there is such a thing as a cleansing, it would be called religious cleansing, but not ethnic. So that's the first question. The second question, it's unclear to me. when someone speaks about actual ethnic cleansing of 90% of the population of the Palestinians by Israel, and where you're worried about attacks by extremist groups, for example, like ISIS, whose major victims have been Sunni Muslims. The majority of those who are killed by ISIS have been Sunni Muslims, not Shiites and not Christians. So to speak of ISIS trying to target only Christians or specifically Christians would be not correct. So you are right. ISIS is a hateful group that hates anyone that does not, or targets anyone that does not abide by its understanding of what it thinks Islam is, especially Muslims. And as we saw last week, it also targeted Egyptian Christians in churches. This is not some ethnic cleansing or religious cleansing campaign by governments or by movements. As you know, in the case of the Palestinians, Palestinian Christians and Muslims have been unified in opposing Zionism since the 1890s, and especially in the 1920s, with associations and organizations that were always integrated in their opposition to Zionist settler colonialism. Exploring sectarianism, if you're suggesting there's sectarianism in the Arab world, but of course there is. There is in America. I mean, if you... the U.S. occupied Iraq, and suddenly you have all the sectarian kind of divisions. I'm sure if a foreign country would occupy the U.S. and be in charge of it, you know, for a year or two, much less five or six, all the existing divisions between blacks and whites, Catholics and Protestants, Southerners and Northerners, urban population and non-urban population, Native Americans and Asian Americans in the Southwest and Latinos, all of that can also be used by a colonizing power to intensify existing differentiation and sectarianism. So, like you, I am very concerned about any sectarianism that targets any minorities in the Arab world, and I usually condemn these people who target minorities and support those who support democratic rule and equality for everyone. And I hope you will as well.
I have a follow-up on that.
Okay.
I have a follow-up version of taking the only democracy in the Middle East and imagine the Palestinians that don't have any democracy whatsoever, not the Palestinian Taliban in Gaza, not the anti-democratic.
Okay.
Shame. There's other people-minded questions besides you.
But thank you very much. But I mean,
listen.
The word democracy. It's my forum. May I answer you? You made your point.
This is
not really an educated question. When you speak of a racialist democracy, it's a problem, right? I mean, you speak as if, for example, like American nationalists who sometimes speak of this country as being a 2.5-century democracy, forgetting that the first century was slavery and the second century was apartheid. True, it was a democracy for white property-owning men for 200-plus years. But it became a democracy that included everyone somewhere around 1970 and stopped around 2001. So there was a 31 period, you know. But to use these kind of sort of ideological terms as if they're actually factual and can translate historically is problematic. Yes, you know, Israel has been a democracy for Ashkenazi Jews. You're absolutely correct. It has accommodated Mizrahi Jews with discrimination. They are seen as equal as Jews and less equal as non-Ashkenazi. And then, may I finish?
Yeah.
And then, of course, the Palestinians who are third-rate citizens in Israel proper, and, of course, those who are subjected to no democracy whatsoever except to be able to elect their Bantustan leaders. You know, South Africa was a forerunner in this, as we know. The South Africans had Gacha Buthelezi, who collaborated with them and would tell everyone, we have homelands for black people. You see, we just believe in separation, and we are equal, separate but equal. For Americans, this is an old refrain. You know, they've heard it a long time ago, and they know what it actually meant and what it translated on the ground. Thank you for your question. Please.
That was Columbia University professor Joseph Massad speaking at Harvard University. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m., You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. To access our permanent archive, go to truthandjusticeradio.org and click on This Week in Palestine Archive. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, unwelcome guests.
Term terrorism, and yet absolutely completely silent about what it means, how it is defined, who uses the term in what ways, and what are the arguments on all sides. From somebody else. The US is not saying in the 70s that it is legitimate to use force against terrorism. If a state is involved directly or indirectly in an act of terrorism, then it's not an act of terrorism. And what's fascinating about the American discourse, or discourses, plural, is that the U.S. has been able to have it both ways, or three ways, or four ways. It has been able to say something to the American public and use a completely different definition at the General Assembly and a completely different definition at the Security Council. And no one knows, because the media, and this is an important part of that whole thing, the media has never covered those debates at the UN. And experts on terrorism have actually not looked at the US position during these debates either. And this applies to US Congress also, where the question of the definition has been talked about over and over and over again. And it's obvious when you look at these debates that there's no agreement within Washington itself about what terrorism is. And yet those debates are not covered. And in the media, the term is used as if everyone's agreed about what terrorism is.
You're listening to episode 747 of Unwelcome Guests, The Tyranny of Enemy Images, Part 2. I'm Robin Upton. Now this week we're picking up with the idea of Marshall Rosenberg's that expression of one's feelings and needs is a good basis for communication and projection of one's judgments, particularly negative judgments about other people, is not a good basis for communication, not one which facilitates empathy and understanding. In other words, we're talking about enemy images. Now, we've just heard a set of remarks from Professor René Poulin, who has extensively researched the use of the word terrorism, how the position has shifted. As we've heard, in the 1970s, violence against terrorists was not part of US policy. So that's the first point to notice, that US policy about dealing with terrorism has shifted over time. Now, the next point to notice is that there's no single concept about who constitutes a terrorist.
there's in fact a multiplicity of concepts which are used at different times for different audiences. As we shall hear, the US has been energetic in trying to avoid discussions about reaching a formal definition of what actually constitutes terrorism. One person's terrorist is another person's freedom fighter, as Ronald Reagan might say. But as we shall hear, Ronald Reagan said a lot of things about terrorism which, according to the modern discourse of the war on terror, are fairly nonsensical. They contradict the sweeping assertions made about terrorists, particularly by politicians and the corporate-controlled media, which seems to amplify and broadcast their sentiment. It seems almost incredible that a concept as highly referenced, as seemingly essential to modern discussion about what goes on in the world, a concept like terrorism, might not have much in the way of an empirical definition. And yet, if we'd said to people in the Middle Ages, perhaps all these witches are just figments of your imagination. Perhaps this whole concept of witchcraft is based on a few separate, unrelated circumstances, and there is no overarching devil behind the whole thing. And all these books, all these treatises written by witch finders general are just so much prejudice, fear, self-serving, whatever, but not actually related to empirical fact. It's not a stretch of the imagination that if you'd stood up and said that in the Middle Ages, even as somebody who was a formerly respected pillar of the community, you might be taking your life in your hands. Well, I don't feel like I'm doing that. I'm not going out on a limb because very, very many people have pointed out that this terroristic emperor has no clothes. The choice which we're being offered, the subtitle of this episode, The Fool's Choice of Totalitarianism or Terrorism, is in fact a complete fiction. Not that there aren't bombs that go off, not that people aren't killed, but I believe more and more people are becoming clear that the choice of hand over all your information to an unelected and effectively unaccountable set of authorities, or face violent and bloody death at the hands of terrorists unknown, is a fake one. We've looked in the past at Operation Gladio, how much of the terrorism during the Cold War blamed on the Soviet Union, that hotbed of terrorist financing. And that was back in the days when if a government did something, it could be classified as terrorism. There seems to be a modern movement against that, neatly sidestepping the whole question of what if governments commit terrorist acts. Now, I don't hear a lot of corporate media, and I don't often play it on this show, but there's nothing like going straight to the horse's mouth. So let's hear from Kim Howells, MP. He was chair of the Intelligence and Security Committee, which was set up in 1994 under the Intelligence Services Act. That provided formal oversight over MI5, MI6 and GCHQ, and it's appointed by MPs. Might seem unusual, but quite a lot of Western democracies until pretty recently didn't actually have a lot of formal oversight over their security services. They're set up in times of war, other great emergencies, and providing public accountabilities is not high on the priority list. It seemed to be much more important to be secret. I think this is, to a certain extent, flying in the face of modern communications technology. Any kind of structure which requires secrecy is likely to be suspect and possibly, in the words of Martin Luther King, on the wrong side of history. If you need that, then you only have to look at developments in modern technology, how much easier it is for ordinary people, unaided, to share information widely. So it's interesting in that regard that Kim Howells chips in a comment about his antipathy to leaks of information. Let's hear what he had to say in March 2015, framing a choice between increased personal information made accessible to intelligence agencies as against increased vulnerability from terrorists.
Now, how much privacy are you willing to sacrifice to help protect you from terrorist attacks? Would you allow the security services access to your internet browser history, or be happy for them to read your messages on your phone?
Today, the parliamentary committee that oversees Britain's spies will say whether the police and intelligence agencies should be given more powers to monitor social media and internet traffic. But what would those powers involve? Kim Howells is a former chair of the Intelligence and Security Committee and joins us from Cardiff. Thank you very much for your time this morning. This is an important day today, a recommendation, and we don't know what that is at this moment. Do you have any indication as to which direction this is going?
No, I don't. I've spoken to no one on the committee, and it's good to know, actually. There have been far too many committee leaks from far too many committees, but I know that they've undertaken a very, very intensive investigation of this whole subject. They've talked to everyone they wanted to talk to, and I hope very much that that now we'll have a proper debate about this, because of course it's extremely important that the terrorists, if you like, are not given an even break. In my opinion, they shouldn't be allowed to communicate in ways which are closed to the intelligence services, because that will result in deaths and mutilations, not just in this country, but around the world.
Well, always discussions around these issues, particularly to do with terrorists and what these agencies are doing, obviously are difficult because information, some of this information has to be held back. But what evidence is there, clear evidence that people can understand, that shows that the agencies need more access to stop terrorist attacks? And recently it's been to do with people traveling, for example, to Syria. But what is the evidence that they need more powers?
Well, the evidence is that they haven't been successful enough. They've been tremendously successful in stopping major plots since the July 2005 bombings in this country, when, remember, 52 people were murdered on the London transport system. They've been tremendously successful at stopping attacks, but they've only got to be unsuccessful once. And that means that they have to have access to as much intelligence as possible. Now, it's quite clear that there's another issue as well running at the same time as this one, and that's to do with do the intelligence and security agencies have enough assets? Do they have enough money? Because if there are thousands of terrorists and terrorist sympathizers out there, how on earth do they keep an eye on them all? And this is a huge subject for debate in this country. We don't want to turn the country into some kind of version of the old East Germany with the Stasi looking at everyone. But on the other hand, the intelligence agencies are going to get it right in the neck if they miss an attack that comes that kills people in this country, which, if they'd had greater assets, more money perhaps, they'd have been able to prevent.
Yes, the point you raised, though, is the one that a lot of people watching this and listening to you will be thinking, is that, yes, we're all on that side of the debate about what to do about terrorism. We want more done. But at the same time, that doesn't mean you want to think that everything you ever do can be accessed at the push of a button by someone in a monitoring centre somewhere. That is a scary proposition for people.
That's a very scary proposition for people, and society's got to decide which way it's going to go on this. Do you want to feel liberated enough to allow your children to walk down the street as they've done for generations, or are you so worried about them that you're going to demand very special protection so that they're not murdered on the streets by some religious fanatic? And that's something society's got to decide on. But it seems to me where the real madness lies is in the notion that there may be encrypted systems, there may be new forms of communication, which terrorists can use, but the security and intelligence services can't use. This seems crazy. It's as if we're saying, well, we're only going to allow intelligence services to use technology to a certain point, but if terrorists go beyond that point, well, I'm afraid there's nothing we can do about it. And that's a debate we've got to have, I'm afraid.
Okay. Mr. Howells, thank you very much for your time this morning. Kim Howells, former MP and ex-chair of the Intelligence and Security Committee. That report will be out a little later today.
Now, that might strike you as an extreme example. I chose it because it was a clear one. I couldn't really say whether it's typical or not. I'm not a heavy consumer of corporate media. I think it's pretty standard that official stories do not explicitly discriminate against the Muslim faith. That may be coming, looking at people like Trump, but I think it's much more common to have the idea of a Muslim fanatic as the subtext. And he's not also saying that terrorists are necessarily people of extreme religious persuasions. But listen to what he does actually say. Let's take another listen to a perhaps slightly less guarded comment towards the end of the interview.
Are you so worried about them that you're going to demand very special protection so that they're not murdered on the streets by some religious fanatic? And that's something society's got to decide on.
So, according to Kim Howells, society has to decide whether to demand very special protection so that we're not risking being murdered on the streets by a religious fanatic. Not necessarily Muslim, although he is suggesting that terrorists appear to be of religious persuasion. And it's a long time since I heard about a fundamentalist atheist or a Jewish or a Buddhist extremist. So that is a way of clarifying the enemy image of the Muslim without actually using the M word. Now, short though it is, that clip does highlight the fool's choice of totalitarianism or terrorism, which is the starting point for our exploration of these enemy images. In the context of that discussion, he is suggesting extra special protection is needed to keep us safe from terrorism. Who doesn't want to be safe? And he's suggesting that extra special protection will be granted, or can be granted, only if the security services are allowed unfettered access to people's consumption of information, say a whole list of people's browsing history and web page downloads. Quite a lot of unquestioned assumptions there, and I wouldn't venture to say how many of those Kim Howells himself has actually explored. I'm not necessarily saying this is disingenuous talk from Mr. Howells. He may be speaking from the point of view of somebody who's thoroughly persuaded that society is full of would-be terrorists and that internet histories are a great way to catch these people. I had a look for this show on what does WikiSpooks tell us about the Intelligence and Security Committee. I've written most of this page myself, actually, over the years, but it's interesting to see what has been accumulated. Apparently, it's an anomalous statutory committee rather than a usual parliamentary select committee, and an attempt in July 2008 to bring it under the administration of Parliament was unsuccessful. It produces an annual report, but its work is invariably classified. So quite for whose benefit that report is, it's unclear to me. Kim Howells' predecessor, Margaret Beckett, on the chair of the committee, attended a group, Le Cercle, which is connected with terrorism and arms dealing, as we've heard in episode 713, and his successor, Malcolm Rifkin, resigned following the Cash for Access scandal. So I don't think I'm going out on a limb to say the personal integrity of these people is perhaps not outstanding. For me, I think the most remarkable piece of evidence on the page is an image, which I'm just going to have to describe, of Mohammed Sadiq Khan and Shehzad Tanweer, two people who have been blamed for the London bombings in 2005. Apparently, and this is all drawn from my good friends, the old corporate media, I don't want you to think they are necessarily an enemy image. I'm doing what I can to try to compliment them, but I haven't got any special knowledge. I'm not involved personally in these events. I'm compiling and processing information on the internet, a lot of which has been put there by corporate media, by probably well-intentioned journalists. I'm recalling John Pilger's assessment of professional journalism as a well-engineered machine to try to ensure a uniformity of perspective, the official, the government perspective. And yet, I've got the picture about the Intelligence and Security Committee of Parliament. There's a picture of the 7-7 bombers, and apparently MI5 had a colour photo of these two men, and according to a report from The Guardian in 2011, in order to try and identify this, rather than just sending an email copy of the picture to somebody, can you identify these people, it processed it. Firstly, it removed the colour, so you have a colour image and you move it into black and white, and then you cut and paste. Literally, it looks like they've done it with a pair of scissors. They cut and they also reduce the quality. So why would you reduce the quality and hand a pathetic copy of an image rather than the original image if you actually genuinely wanted somebody's help to identify the men in the image? Far from clear to me. As The Guardian noted in 2011, the committee appears not to have been aware of the original, very clear, colour photograph of both men. So this doesn't seem to me to be too much to believe, that there is a committee which thinks it's in charge of the intelligence services, but yet which doesn't receive full operational details for reasons of national security. The intelligence agencies have their own reasons. It's told by smiling establishment figures, well, look, I'm in charge of this service and I'm telling you this is all you need to know. It might just be there to rubber stamp a predetermined conclusion. Now, if it is a facade, if it's a front, then why not seek out people who are lacking the ability to perceive that themselves? If you have somebody who knows it's a fake committee, there's always a danger that they'll spill the beans. If you've got somebody who, for whatever reason, doesn't actually even notice, perhaps you have a chairman of the committee who's so worried about the fact that he might be blown up on the street by a religious fanatic that he actually has not properly questioned and not looked closely at the evidence. So it could be that the tyranny of the enemy image is so powerful in its ability to corrupt proper thinking that rational, otherwise reasonably intelligent and well-informed people reach erroneous conclusions. Now, I was going to leave my look at the corporate media at that, but then I found myself randomly reading another Guardian article. This is from 2014, and the headline is "Government Agents Directly Involved," that's in quotes, "in most high-profile US terror plots." This is based on a report from a group called Human Rights Watch. I won't read it all out, but one point that I noticed, we hear later from René Brulin about a 1996 law that was brought in a year after Oklahoma City bombing relating to material support for terrorism. Well, the article notes that the plurality of convictions of terrorist-related cases in the US, this is a matter of a few hundred, are not for thwarted plots, but for material support charges. A broad category expanded further by the 2001 Patriot Act that permits prosecutors to pursue charges with tenuous connections to a terrorist act or group. In one such incident, the initial basis for a material support case alleging a man provided military gear to Al-Qaeda turned out to be waterproof socks in his luggage. Now, what could possess a prosecutor to identify socks in luggage as part of a terrorist threat? Seems to me that is more based on fear. He's a prosecutor. How do we prosecute this guy? He is, after all, a terrorist. Now, yeah, this is, in a sense, nothing very remarkable here, but it is about enemy images. The adversarial justice system is explicitly based upon the idea that there's good guys and bad guys, and punishment sentences are about handing people what is their due. And Marshall Rosenberg, I think, quite elegantly criticizes all of this as being a counterproductive way to try to administer this thing called justice, which we think we would be well advised to not let the US Justice Department claim a monopoly upon. Now, another statistic about these terrorist cases, 30% of them involve informants who played a, quote, active role, unquote, in incubating plots leading to arrest. So it notes that entrapment is pretty difficult to prove. Another point is that in terrorist cases, the usual laws about laws don't seem to apply. So it gives an example of defendant Ahmed Omar Abu Ali, who was held in solitary confinement for 5 years before his trial. He says he was tortured while he was in Saudi Arabian jail, and his confession, because it was a terrorist case alleged, then this was allowable evidence. Now, we'll read the last page of this report because I think it's very cogent to the topic of enemy images. I quote, "Another implication of the law enforcement tactic cited in the report is a deepening alienation of American Muslims from a government that publicly insists it needs their support to head off extremism, but secretly deploys informants to infiltrate mosques and community centres." Quote, "The best way to prevent violent extremism inspired by violent jihadists is to work with the Muslim American community, which has consistently rejected terrorism, to identify signs of radicalization and partner with law enforcement when an individual is drifting towards violence. And these partnerships can only work when we recognize that Muslims are a fundamental part of the American family." Unquote. Obama said in a high-profile 2013 speech. Yet, the Obama administration has needed to purge Islamophobic training materials from FBI counterterrorism, which sparked deep suspicion in US Muslim communities. It's now considering a review of similar material in the intelligence community after a document leaked by Edward Snowden used the slur Mohammed Raghead as a placeholder for Muslims. Unquote. So there's multiple backstories here, this idea about violent extremism as a replacement for terrorism. We've looked at the notion about radicalization as an ongoing narrative to promote internet censorship. What we're not, according to this public narrative, is in any shape or form prejudiced against Muslims. Now, recalling that in 30% of the post-9/11 terrorist cases, there's at least one informant who played a, quote, active role, unquote, in incubating the terrorist plot. So I can quite see how law enforcement operatives or informants might wish to partner with impressionable young people. I can see that there's a commercial value in knowing the names and addresses and histories, the contact details of people who can be depicted as drifting towards radical or violent action. As the public face, the high-profile speech, as we heard from the very beginning, this word terrorism is used in multiple contexts. It's associated with an enemy image. How to make that very clear? Well, a group of white American good old boys want to make that clear might very well use a phrase such as Mohammed Raghead. If you're going to kill people, if you're going to plot how to blow them up and then say they were suicide bombers, how better to do that than by designating them clearly as bad guys? Establish an enemy image as a way of stemming moral anxiety about the task. So the multiple lives of this word terrorism is one of the reasons why I'm wanting to avoid it. Let's be clear on what's actually happening. Let's not infer things from the colour of people's skin, from their names or their religion. I suggest we would do well to stick to the facts, ditch the enemy image of the terrorist. If we're going to ditch the word terrorist, there's a whole raft of legislation goes along with that. Well, if we haven't properly defined what a terrorist is, and certainly at the international level, this is all pretty suspect stuff, in my opinion anyway. At a national level, I think we've got no shortage of laws for dealing with offenders. As an illustration of the power of enemy images to truncate thinking, I teach English here in Bangladesh, and one of my former students told me firsthand of his first encounter as a freshman in a US college with his roommate, who asked him nervously on seeing his skin colour, "Are you from Islam?" and had to be disabused of the notion that Islam was a country as opposed, of course, to a religion. And that, I think, is a very common pairing. A powerful enemy image reinforced by heaven knows how many hours in front of a television reporting about suspected terrorists, an enemy image associated with lack of information. Perhaps it's because I live in a country where there's about a 90% Muslim population. I can't see these people as violent. These are the people who surround me. I could drift off to talking about money and how our economic system poses that the world is made up of people who are inimical to one another, surrounded by enemies in competition. But no, we're going to keep the focus on this word terrorism and its ability to inspire fear, correlated with a lack of information. Now, that's really what I'm trying to get at. My core focus in this episode is, are we allowing our natural tendency for fear? We have a whole set of body systems about getting out of extreme danger, about anxiety, adrenaline. Are we allowing something that we are biologically predisposed to, fear, to cloud our judgment? I believe there's a very small, very, very small number of people deliberately manipulating large numbers of people with this idea of terrorism.
Police are looking into whether the killing is terror-related.
What on earth does that mean? I've seen it several times. If one person kills another person, that's probably pretty terrifying for the person on the receiving end. What does it mean to say the killing was not terror-related? I think these are perhaps not for regular unwelcome guest listeners, but for a lot of people, points where it's worth stopping to think, and where this is such a part of everyday corporate media discourse that the fact that it seems to lack any kind of clear empirical meaning, what's this actually talking about, may be obscured. Now, that's at least enough from me. Let's hear Professor René Brulin sharing details of his research into the use of the word terrorism. Now, I've done what I can with this interview. It was over Skype, and René Brulin is not a native speaker. There are occasions where his accent I found quite difficult to follow, but I've edited it. The original, of course, I shall link to from this show's webpage on welcomeguest.net/747. Many thanks to Palestine Studies TV for this interview and publishing it on YouTube. It was recorded in 2012.
I'll be talking to René Brulin, a research fellow at New York University, about the concept of terrorism and its use in the Israeli-Palestinian context. Remy, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, with the current military escalation against the Gaza Strip, there's been a lot of talk in the mainstream media about terrorism. Has that conversation been reflective of the way the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is usually handled?
Yeah, the short answer would be yes, I think. I want to note, however, that there might be some improvement or change in how the mainstream media is starting to cover the conflict. One possible case in point could be the program Apris Ace that took place was on Sunday morning on MSNBC, where for probably one of the very first times you had several Palestinian voices actually on the sets and so giving a different perspective on conflicts. So I felt like this was new. However, I'm not sure that this can be said about the way in which the media has covered the issue of terrorism itself. This still remains to me the one point about the conflict about which the media used the term terrorism and yet absolutely, completely silent about what it means, how it is defined, who uses the term in what ways, and what are the arguments, all sides. I think there was something interesting that happened. The Prime Minister of Turkey, Erdogan, actually called Israel a terrorist state. It was reported in the media, and something that was interesting is how Matthew Lee from AP actually asked a spokesperson for the Obama administration to respond and to probably condemn Erdogan. And so there was this interesting exchange where at the end, the spokesperson actually said that, of course, the U.S. disagreed and thought it was not helpful. At the same time, Senator McCain and Senator Graham, Republicans, both issued a statement also saying that they regretted what the Turkish prime minister said. And I have the statement in front of me, and they start by saying, "We regret that the prime minister of Turkey referred to Israel today as a terrorist state, quote unquote. Israel has the same sovereign right as every country to defend itself, and no government could be expected to remain passive under the daily barrage of rockets, etc." And then they add, "This challenge should be familiar to Turkey, which has been a victim of terrorism itself." To me, this response is interesting because they don't really say anything about whether Israel is a terrorist state there. Mm-hmm. Or rather, if this is what they're saying, their argument is basically that you cannot be involved in terrorism if what you're doing is defending yourself against terrorism. Which, of course, as an argument, makes no sense. It is an argument that basically confuses two issues. The issues, if we talk in international law terms or in just war theory terms, you have two concepts, right? You have jus ad bellum, the right to go to war, and jus in bello, the rights when you're fighting, when you're in war. Michael Walzer, author of Just and Unjust Wars, professor, talks about it as one is an adjective, you fight a just war, and one is an adverb, you fight justly. And the two are completely separate. What McCain and Graham here are saying is confusing the two because it's obvious, talk about war, for example, both sides can be committing war crimes. Both can be fighting unjustly, the adverb. And so in the case of terrorism, it is also obvious, or it should be, that both sides can be terrorists using terrorism. And it, of course, makes no sense to say I'm not a terrorist because I'm fighting against the terrorists. It's obvious because the other side can say that. And of course, historically, the other side has said that. Arab states or the Palestinians, many others, the ANC, are fighting South Africa. They've all said at some point that they're not terrorists because they're fighting the terrorists. And obviously, when they use that argument, it's an argument that we reject, and we're right to reject it. So the answer here given by McCain and Graham really makes little sense. But what's more important probably is that this is where the debate on the issue stops. It's further than that. And in the media, this was the end of it. Because it's taken as obvious that it's a crazy idea to think of Israel as using terrorism.
Well, let's focus a little bit on the U.S. for a while. Can you speak about how historically the U.S. government has used the term terrorism, specifically in this Israeli-Palestinian context?
So here, I think something that's important is to, when we're talking about the U.S. government, is to sort of separate in branches. Something that I've done a lot of research about is trying to figure out when the discourse on terrorism or when the word terrorism starts being used in presidential discourse, right? And it's easy to do now, today, something that was not the case maybe 10 years ago, because we have those databases online and so we can look for this. And what you find is that actually up until Reagan, the word terrorism is basically not used by American presidents, right? Carter uses it a lot during the last year and a half of his term, but it's only about the hostage crisis in Iran. In that sense, there is no discourse on terrorism, as in terrorism itself is not presented or framed as a threat. It's only about Iran and that act of terrorism. If you go back, I go in more detail about this in an interview that I did with Greenwald on Salon a couple of years ago. But very quickly, even if you look at the attacks by the Palestinians on Israeli athletes at Munich in 72 during the Olympic Games, this is the obvious example of terrorism that we can think of when we think about the conflict. And yet at the time, Nixon, so he's president at the time, he does not use the term terrorism to talk about Munich. He calls them international outlaws. He calls them thugs. Of course, the act is rightly described as despicable, illegal, and everything. But it does not naturally refer to it as an act of terrorism. In the same way, you had hijackings throughout the 60s up and into the 70s. The very first president to ever use the term terrorism to refer to an act against civil aviation is, again, Nixon in March of 72, which is very late in the day, when he gives his a speech presenting the creation of the air marshals. It's oddly on September 11, 1970, which is odd. He talks about hijackings and bombings of civilian airplanes. Not once does he call it terrorism. So what's important to remember when you look back on that history is that terrorism is an umbrella term. What it does is that it puts all those acts together and say that those acts form one threat and that it's just one threat and the same threat. This is not something that was felt as natural or that American presidents felt like they needed to do up until the 80s and Reagan, basically. I'm not saying here, because it would be historically profoundly inaccurate, that the term did not exist before. Of course, in the 60s and the 70s, Israel, for example, used the term all the time to refer to use of force by Palestinians or pro-Palestinian groups. And it's important to mention that, to refer to attacks against civilian targets, but also against military targets. In the Israeli discourse, there is no difference between the two.
What was the turning point in the 80s then that made the discourse change?
when you go back and you look at the first 2 or 3 years of the Reagan term, what's odd in retrospect is that he's actually not really using the term to refer to events in the Middle East. What he's really referring to is events in Central America. And when he's talking about terrorism, he's mostly talking about the FMLN in El Salvador and saying that the U.S. should give military aid to the Salvadoran regime so that they can fight terrorism. It's mostly where it is focused. If there is one point where we can say that when it comes to the presidential discourse, things do change, it's with the attack against the U.S. Marines stationed in Beirut in October of 83. What's fascinating when you go back is that since the beginning of the crisis between Israel and Lebanon, if we can talk about a specific beginning, let's say June of 81, well, when we're talking about Beirut and the headquarters of the PLO that are bombed in June of 81, Israel, of course, is saying that what they're going after is the headquarters of this big terrorist organization that is the PLO, and that they go against the terrorist infrastructure of the PLO. But the U.S. is not saying that. At least Reagan does not say that. He mentions terrorism a couple times when talking about Israel and what Israel is doing once it invades Lebanon 1 year later in June of 82. But that's it. So from June 82 to October 83, maybe a couple mentions of terrorism. So when he talks about Israel and Lebanon, this is not about terrorism. It's about something else. And suddenly, as soon as the U.S. Marines are attacked and bombed and 250 of them are killed by a truck bomb, suddenly it becomes about terrorism, meaning that the U.S. presence is about terrorism. The U.S. objectives become about fighting terrorism and defeating the terrorists. And at the same time, retroactively, in hindsight, starts talking about the reason why Israel invaded a year earlier in 82, as of course having been about fighting the terrorists, right? So suddenly, retroactively, what happened a year before is presented as of course obviously having been about fighting terrorism. And then at the same time, we are in October of 83, the U.S. invades Grenada, and you have a Korean, I think, airplane that is downed by the Soviet Union. It's an accident, but Reagan calls it an act of terrorism, and he has this big discourse in late 83 when he says that all these things are happening thousands of miles apart, one from the other, but they're all part of the same big threat, the threat of international terrorism. And at the heart of this threat of international terrorism is, of course, the Soviet Union. We're in the middle of the Cold War, and its allies, and amongst its allies, you have Arab states, and you have the Central American states like the Sandinistas in Nicaragua and Cuba. And so suddenly you have this huge threat. It's the same threat. They're all the same. They're all the terrorists, and we have to fight the terrorists. So that's really the turning point. But something that's important, again, is that in a way what the U.S. is doing from late 83 onwards is incorporate or is take the Israeli discourse. Right, and here the something that's of course interesting is the role that an organization like the Jonathan Institute, which is called the Jonathan Institute, it's an Israeli organization called Jonathan after Benjamin Netanyahu's brother, who was killed during the raid at Entebbe in 76, so a member of the Israeli special forces, and the objective of this Jonathan Institute. They have conferences about terrorism. The first big conference takes place in 79 in Jerusalem, and the second one takes place in Washington in 84. And the objective stated explicitly is to convince the rest of the world, the West or the civilized world, as they call it, that there is a threat, that it's the threat that Israel has been fighting against is also a threat that the whole Western world should fight against. I have a quotation from the Jonathan Institute, if you want. In 79, Netanyahu gave the objective of the Jonathan Institute's conference in Jerusalem as being to focus public attention on the real nature of international terrorism, on the threat that it poses to all democratic societies, and on the measures necessary for defeating the forces of terror. And in 84, the second conference, this time it takes place in Washington, reminds everyone that a few years before the first conference exposed for the first time the full involvement of states in international terrorism and the centrality of the Soviet Union and the PLO in fomenting and spreading terrorism. But he adds, though the conference helped focus the attention of influential circles in the West on the real nature of the terrorist threat, this was not enough. What was still lacking was a coherent and united international response. To advocate such a united policy and to suggest what it might consist of is the principal objective of the Washington Conference. And indeed, during that second conference in 84, most of the emphasis is going to be on the question of how to respond to international terrorism, and more specifically on the question of the use of force, preemptively or preventively, against terrorism. And of course, most, if not all, of the participants at the conference, and this includes officials of the Reagan administration, you have George Shultz, who is the Secretary of State at the time, you have Jane Kirkpatrick, who is the U.S. ambassador at the U.N. at the time, and many other American officials and Israeli officials all come on the side of course, the necessity of the West having what they call moral clarity and pushing aside what they call moral equivalency, being very clear about who the terrorists are and who the enemy is and how serious the threat is. And they all come on the side of the use of force against international terrorism. And some of them, in fact, explicitly give the invasion of Lebanon as the example that the West should follow in fighting international terrorism. This is at the end of the first term during the Reagan administration. At the time, there are internal debates inside the Reagan administration about the morality and the legality of using force against terrorism. This is not something that everyone agrees on. Within the Reagan administration, you have debates broadly explained between, on one side, Shultz and the State Department, on the other side, the DOD and Weinberger. And the DOD is reluctant to actually use force against terrorism. They don't think it's a serious threat, and they're bothered by the morality of it. And Reagan himself, it's unclear where he is on this issue, but there are several quotes where you can really see how far we've gone today when we talk about the use of force against terrorism. Reagan, in November 27th, 84, to give you the background, in late January 81, Reagan is welcoming back the American hostages from Tehran, and he gives a famous speech where he promises the American people that the terrorists will be met with swift retribution. And so throughout his first and then his second term, journalists are going to be asking, when are we going to see journalists or critics of the administration from the right are going to be asking, when are we going to see those swift retributions? Because, of course, you have hostages in Beirut and other acts of terrorism all over the place, and the U.S. is not using force. And so many times Reagan actually has to answer those questions. And this is how he answers. November 27th, 84. You've got to be able to get some evidence as to where are the bases from whence come these terrorists that you could strike at. At the same time, you have to recognize that you don't want to just carelessly go out and maybe kill innocent people. Then you're as bad as the terrorists. A few weeks later, that's January 14th, 85, right now the terrorists, one of the things that has kept us from retaliation is the difficulty in getting definite information enough as to who they are and where they are, that you do not risk killing, doing the same thing they're doing, killing innocent people in an effort to get at them. Same thing in February, where he clearly says that if you do that, you're a terrorist. Same thing in June, where he again says that if you use force and kill a lot of innocents and it's indiscriminate, you're a terrorist too. And of course, that takes us back to the argument, if you want to call it that, that's put forward by McCain and Graham in their statement. You can use the words of Ronald Reagan to show very clearly that you can be a terrorist when you're fighting the terrorist, if the means that you use are fully indiscriminate. And it's striking to me that to be critical, say, of Israel's actions today in Gaza, you only have to go back to Reagan and quote him. And it's difficult to not reach the conclusion that, at least in some respects, in certain specific cases of certain specific strikes, Israel is using means that Reagan would have called terrorism. And there's the last one that's interesting also on the issue of targeted killings or targeted assassinations. Of course, only 10 years ago, this was not U.S. official policy. You only need to go back to just before 9/11 to find Democrats being extremely critical of the idea of a targeted killing when used by Israel, and Republicans being critical of it up to basically August of 2001. This is something that the U.S. rejects. And this is what Reagan said in January of 86. Senator Metzenbaum said that the U.S. should be thinking seriously about assassinating Muammar Gaddafi. And so Reagan was asked about what he thought, and he said, "You don't join them at their level. Terrorism in response to terrorism is not the answer. It is terrorism that is the evil. There is a moral issue involved here." Which is a great quote, because it reminds us that it is terrorism itself that is the evil, meaning that the only way that a stance against terrorism is morally principled is if we apply it to all sides, which seems pretty obvious, but that makes very clear that a statement such as the one by McCain and Graham doesn't answer any of the big questions. And it shows, of course, how far the terms of the debate have evolved.
I would say, actually, yes, language evolves. Yes, politicians exploit events. They react to what happens. But deep politicians are agents of change. So if it's not acceptable to use violence in the 1970s, it might not be coincidental that now we see violence used on a regular basis, guns paraded up and down the cities of Western capitals, where previously this would not have been easy to contemplate. Now, quick break for change of pace. This is from Monty Python's Flying Circus.
Well, I've been a hunter all my life. I love animals. That's why I like to kill them. Good day, Roy.
Hank and Rospin are tough, fearless backwoodsmen who have chosen to live in a violent, unrelenting world of nature's creatures where only the fittest survive. Today, they are off to hunt mosquitoes.
Mosquito's a clever little bastard. You can track him for days and days until you really get to know him like a friend. He knows you're there, and you know he's there. It's a game of wits. You hate him, then you respect him, then you kill him.
Suddenly, Hank spots the mosquito they're after. Now, more than ever, they must rely on the skills they have learned from a lifetime's hunting. Hank gauges the wind. Roy examines the mosquito's spoor. Then... It's a success. The mosquito lies dead. But Roy must make sure.
There's nothing more dangerous than a wounded mosquito.
But the hunt is not over. With well-practiced skill, Hank skins the mosquito. The wings of a fully grown male mosquito can fetch anything up to 0.8 of a penny in the open market. The long day is over, and it's back to base camp for a night's rest. Here, surrounded by their trophies, Roy and Hank prepare for a much tougher ordeal, a moth hunt.
Well, I follow the moth in the helicopter to lure it away from the flowers, and then Roy comes along in the Lockheed Starfighter and attacks it with air-to-air missiles.
A lot of people have asked us why we don't use fly spray. Well, where's the sport in that?
For Roy, sport is everything. Ever since he lost his left arm battling with an ant, Roy has risked his life in the pursuit of tiny creatures. But it's not all work, and for relaxation, they like nothing more than a day's fishing.
Wherever there is a challenge, Hank and Roy Spim will be there, ready to carry on the primordial struggle between man and inoffensive tiny insects.
You're listening to hour two of episode 747 of Unwelcome Guests. The Fool's Choice of Totalitarianism or Terrorism. We continue with Annie Brulin's comments on the changing meanings of the word terrorism, especially when used by politicians and the corporate media.
The US has accepted what Israel has always said about how to fight terrorism. And this is, in fact, something that the Israel has always said at the UN, the Security Council, when there has been criticism about its uses of force.
And so do you think that the US has kind of mirrored the Israeli discourse because of lobbying by groups like the Jonathan Group, or is it related to the US's own history and its own wars? For example, in Afghanistan and in Iraq?
That's one of the questions that it's difficult as a historian to answer, because I'm not in the head of any of those American leaders. I don't know what they thought and why exactly they did it that way. What is very clear is that the current American stance on how to fight terrorism, meaning that it is legitimate to use force against the terrorists and against the states that harbor or support the terrorists. It is new in the American discourse, but it is not new when you go back to how the US talked about those questions at the Security Council in the specific case of Israel being accused by various Arab states or the Soviet Union and its allies of using force against the terrorists. Since 72, in fact, on September 10th, 1972, following Munich and the airstrikes by Israel against various terrorist, quote-unquote, camps in neighboring countries, the Security Council deals with the issue of the use of force against terrorism. And the U.S. uses its veto. It's only the second time in its history that at the time it uses its veto. George Bush, Sr., of course, is the U.S. ambassador at the time, and he explains that from now on, the U.S. position is going to be to veto any resolution that is one-sided. And by one-sided, he explains the U.S. means that is critical of or it condemns uses of force by Israel without at the same time giving the context, and by context it means that the root causes of the use of force by Israel is the question of terrorism and the role of states in terrorism. So this is on September 10th, 1972. The U.S. is not saying in the 70s that it is legitimate to use force against terrorism. It simply is saying that this is the framework within which the use of force by Israel should be seen. But at the same time, it always uses its veto whenever a resolution is going to condemn Israel and condemn its uses of force, and also uses its veto, or rather threatens to use its veto, whenever the other members of the Security Council want to call what Israel did state terrorism. And if you indeed look at the debates throughout the 70s, from the beginning and up until now, whenever the issue of the use of force by Israel is brought up, many states are of the position that what Israel does and has done for many years, and what the Zionist groups did before the creation of the State of Israel, is terrorism. And if you look at the drafts of so many resolutions put forward during those years, the word state terrorism is there very, very often. But it never appears in the final resolutions, because if it is even put on the table, the U.S. threatens to veto. Sometimes the U.S. even threatens to veto if there is mention of civilian casualties caused by Israeli strikes. So this has been the position of the U.S. since 72 at the U.N. Security Council. And the first time that the U.S. actually makes it its own official position, in 85, when it sends jet airplanes to hijack, quote-unquote, plane that where the Achille Lauro terrorists were flying. And then in 86, when the U.S. Had some missile strikes against an airplane strikes against Libya. And then from that moment on, it becomes actually the U.S. position at the Security Council in that one case that it is legitimate to use force against terrorists and the terrorist states. But it took 14, 15 years, and then it would more or less disappear for a few years and come back here and there. But it has been the position of Israel from the very beginning. You can read speeches given by Israeli representative in 72, and they literally sound like the speeches by Bush, meaning a W. Bush, post 9/11 speeches at the UN. They sound exactly the same. What's interesting, though, is that the U.S. takes a very different position at the General Assembly as opposed to the Security Council. And it sort of makes sense, because at the General Assembly, they don't have veto power. And so what they're going to do, and really to summarize very, very quickly, during the Reagan years, what the U.S. is going to be saying, because it's faced with accusations of state terrorism or state-sponsored terrorism all the time at the General Assembly, right? You have non-aligned countries, or you have Soviet Union allies who consistently state that the U.S. is involved in state terrorism or state-sponsored terrorism. The state terrorism is during the 70s, for example, because of Vietnam. It is from the get-go, because from the 70s on, because of U.S. support for South Africa and for all the states, South Africa is a terrorist state because of apartheid and the terrorist regime. It's because of U.S. support for Israel, and of course for all those states, Israel itself is a terrorist state. And so U.S. support for those states means that it's also involved in state terrorism, but also accusations for state-sponsored terrorism. For example, the support for the Contras in the 80s is, for a majority of member states at the General Assembly, a clear case of state-sponsored terrorism by the U.S., or the role of the CIA in Nicaragua, mining the harbors in 84, for example, is for them clearly an act of state-sponsored terrorism, or the roles of the anti-Castro Cubans in Florida and their role is in acts of terrorism is for them a clear case of the U.S. sponsoring terrorism, or at least harboring terrorists and not doing anything against them. So in that context, an extremely adversarial context, the U.S., during the 80s, during the Reagan years, it's not going to deny all those acts. What it's going to say is that if a state is involved in an act of terrorism in any way, shape, or form, meaning if a state is involved directly or indirectly in an act of terrorism, then it's not an act of terrorism, right? So they're going to say in 81, in 83, 85, 87, 89, and 91, every other year, they're going to say that those accusations make no sense in the context of debates about international terrorism, because they refer to acts in which a state, the U.S., the United States, is involved. And if that's the case, it's already covered by international law, by the U.N. Charter, etc. And therefore, and they use those terms, it is neither useful nor necessary to use the term international terrorism to condemn those acts, because they're already covered by international law, right? So that's what they keep repeating throughout the 80s. And of course, in a way, this legal argument, because this takes place in the Sixth Committee, the legal committee of the General Assembly, where the debates on international terrorism have happened since 72, following Munich. The argument makes sense from a legal standpoint because it has the merit of not separating state-sponsored terrorism and state terrorism, right? So if a state is involved, either you decide that it's terrorism, and so you accept both concepts, or you decide that it's not, and so you reject both. But you don't split it in two, because legally it makes no sense, because the issue is state responsibility. Really makes no sense to say that state-sponsored terrorism exists, for example, but state terrorism, as in the direct use of force by a state, for example, by its, I don't know, intelligence services agents, it doesn't make sense to say that this does not exist. And there's a very specific case that's put forward by the U.S. in 83. You had an assassination attempt in Rangoon against the South Korean prime minister. And for the first two or three weeks, everyone thought that it was a non-state act, right, by a group of North Koreans. And then there's an investigation, and everyone realizes that actually the perpetrators were members of the North Korean army, two officers from the North Korean army. And so during the subsequent debates on international terrorism at the UN, the US is going to be the only country to state that the committee should not be talking about Rangoon, because Rangoon is not an act of international terrorism. And specifically, Rosenstock, who is the representative of the U.S. at the time, says very clearly that for a few weeks, we thought that it was an act of terrorism, the kind that the committee should be talking about and acting against. But actually, it turns out that it's state agents. And because it's state agents, it's not an act of terrorism, because it's already covered by international law, right? And so this argument makes sense, and it has the obvious benefit for the U.S. and the General Assembly that, by definition, the U.S. cannot be involved in terrorism, because if a state is involved, it's not terrorism. The problem is that at the same time, Ronald Reagan, when he talks to the American people, is every other day talking about state-sponsored terrorism, and in fact mentions Rangoon and mentions the attack against the Marines and mentions the Soviet Union downing an airplane, all acts in which states are involved, and uses that to create this international terrorist threat. And of course, you cannot have it both ways. But what's fascinating about the American discourse, or discourses, plural, is that the U.S. has been able to have it both ways, or three ways, or four ways. It has been able to say something to the American public and use a completely different definition at the General Assembly, and a completely different definition at the Security Council. And no one knows, because the media, and this is an important part of that whole thing, the media has never covered those debates at the UN. And experts on terrorism have actually not looked at the US position during these debates either. And this applies to US Congress also, where the question of the definition has been talked about over and over and over again. And it's obvious when you look at these debates that there's no agreement within Washington itself about what terrorism is. And yet those debates are not covered. And in the media, the term is used as if everyone agreed about what terrorism is, which of course is absolutely not the case.
And now, more recently, the State Department issued a report designating some acts of Israeli settler violence as terrorism. How significant is that report?
Yeah, the report came out at some point in August, and it was reported as significant and as the first time that the State Department had used the term terrorism to talk about not Palestinians only, but actually Israeli settlers. So it is true that this is what the State Department did, but it was not the first time. I looked it up, and it's very easy to check because everything is online, and you can go back all the way to 85 and find mention of Israeli extremists, for example, killing, attacking two mayors in the West Bank. And this is called an act of terrorism by the State Department. So it's not really new, but probably more importantly, it shouldn't surprise us either that the State Department does use the term terrorism when it talks about extremist settlers, nor that this is also how the Israeli government speaks about those acts, because there's nothing about this such a position that is actually threatening to the discourse on terrorism. And in fact, if you look in there, you have at least one attack that is of Israeli settlers attacking Israeli IDF soldiers, right? And of course, the two big issues about the definition of terrorism are, does state terrorism exist, or is it only groups that can be called terrorists? And of course, this is simply confirming the fact that settlers, meaning non-state actors, can be terrorists. So it's not in that sense threatening to the discourse on terrorism. And the other issue is whether all uses of force by non-state actors are terrorism, or only specific instances, only those against innocent civilians or non-combatants. And in this case, clearly the State Department and the Israeli government is using the term terrorism to talk about Israeli settlers attacking military IDF soldiers. This has been also like a very central argument at the General Assembly, because for one side in the debate, the issue has always been that to them, the West, spoken of broadly, the West is using the term terrorism to refer to all uses of force by what they call national liberation movements, right? For example, South Africa is calling whatever the ANC does violently, sabotage, economic sabotage, terrorism. And they have their own laws about terrorism, and terrorism is defined extremely broadly in those laws. And this is what Israel is doing also. And in fact, for the first time in 87, Syria put forward a proposal when the resolutions on international terrorism were proposed, a proposal that said that there should be an international conference to define terrorism and differentiate between terrorism and legitimate uses of force for national liberation, right? The positions of all unaligned and Soviet Union allies country, meaning the huge majority of member states, were in favor of having such a conference because they want a definition of terrorism, because they feel that this term has not been defined and is always used against them. And they feel like they need the protection that a definition that's agreed upon by everybody would give them. So they're in favor of it, which is not to say, of course, that they all agree on what terrorism would be. But what is striking is that Syria, actually, in 83 and 85 and 87, very explicitly said, what we're interested in is that there is a clear difference between attacking civilians and, for example, they talk about the Achille Lauro and the Palestinians and said, this is against civilians, this is terrorism, there is no doubt. But, and they give examples of forces in the Golan Heights and their own territories that are occupied at the time, and said, suicide attacks against occupying military forces are not acts of terrorism, right? So that's their position, and Syria's position is very clear. Again, it's not the case for all Arab states. Some of them say that give the impression that if it's for a good cause, it's not terrorism, right? But Syria is very clear. And on the other side, Israel and the U.S. opposed to the idea of an international conference on terrorism in 87, since 72, in fact, in 87 and since then, just like the rest of the Western world has been opposed. The argument being that there will not be an agreement because it's too difficult, so we should not have a conference. The U.S. and Israel very clearly, when they react to what Syria said, clearly say that for them, this is an act of terrorism, right? That suicide attack, obviously it's extremely violent, it's a suicide attack, but the target is military. And for them, it is, and it should be considered an act of terrorism. That was the position of the US in those years. And it's in fact very difficult to figure out exactly, if you look at debates at the General Assembly, what is the actual official position of the US on the question of the legitimacy of the use of force by non-state actors. They basically do not talk about it openly, but their votes against various self-determination resolutions in other committees give the sense that apparently they continue to reject the idea that it is legitimate to use force, any kind of force, if you're a non-state actor. And of course, it's ironic because this is the 80s and this is the Reagan Doctrine years. And of course, the Reagan Doctrine is about freedom fighters and how, to quote Reagan from his State of the Union address in early 85, support for freedom fighters is self-defense. So again, you have a clear contrast between what the US say at the UN about the use of force, where it's illegitimate, and most of it, if not all of it, is terrorism. And at the same time, you have Reagan saying that support for freedom fighters not only is fine, but it's actually self-defense. And of course, the two are not compatible, and the only way that they are is, and that no one knows, is because the media, once again, does not cover those issues.
You've touched upon this briefly before, but I just wanted to get your take on where the U.S. Congress stands in all of this.
So on the issue broadly of terrorism, Congress sort of starts talking about it and have hearings about international terrorism per se in and of itself for the first time in 74. And what's interesting is that at the time, the experts that are called to talk about terrorism have no problem talking about state terrorism. So non-state terrorism, of course, but also state terrorism. And they actually have no problem talking about certain uses of force by the U.S. in Vietnam as being acts of state terrorism, uses of force by Israel, as not all of them, but some of them, as being acts of state terrorism. So that's 74. And those experts are not radical leftists. You have Brian Jenkins, who works for the RAND Corporation at the time and is a very well-known terrorism expert. You have Ernst Lefebvre, who was very close to being an official under Reagan and everything. So those are not radicals. Throughout the 70s, the issue of terrorism comes up in the context of Latin America and Central America, disappearances, death squads, and all that. This is considered terrorism. And then, more importantly to the subject at hand right now, and from 77 to 79, you have discussions about the idea of coming up with a list of state sponsors of terrorism. This is an idea that comes from Senators Javits and Ribicoff, a Democrat and a Republican. Their idea is to come up with a list of terrorist state, and very, very clearly the focus would be on the states who give aid and support to the PLO. You have very long debates, and of course there is a tug of war, a struggle between the executive branch and the legislative branch. And at the time, the context, of course, is Carter trying to negotiate the Camp David Accords. And he realizes that such a list would tie his hands because suddenly he would not be allowed to talk with those states because they would be on the list, Egypt and other states that he's talking to at the time. So there's a tug of war, and there's the issue of the definition. And there is no agreement amongst Democrats or Republicans exactly about how you could define terrorism in such a way that, for example, Saudi Arabia would not be on the list. Because, of course, at the time, Saudi Arabia is giving support to the PLO and other terrorist groups. But no one in Congress or in the executive branch would want to have Saudi Arabia on the list and then have to take sanctions or not be allowed to give support to Saudi Arabia, so sell Saudi Arabia weapons or whatever. So it fails. The Congress is not able at the time to come up with a list, but and yet we have a list. And it's because Fenwick, who was a representative from New Jersey, actually picked up the idea of the list and put it on the rider to a larger bill. And it was accepted without any debates. And so a few months later, the State Department because according to that Fenwick amendment, it was up to the State Department to designate the sponsors of terrorists. Following that, we have the list, and we have four or five states who are on the list, and then they'll be on and off. So this is how the Congress started dealing with the issue. And then there's they dealt also with the issue of material support for terrorism, which is something that is very important these days, and that the Supreme Court just ruled on in a few important cases recently. There are debates about this in 84, for the first time, long debates. And once again, there's absolute inability on the part of Congress to legislate on material support for terrorism, because there's complete disagreement on who the terrorists are. Because for the Democrats, the DNC, for example, are not terrorists, whereas they are terrorists for the Republicans. The FMLN might be terrorists, but not all Democrats would agree. More importantly for them, the death squads in El Salvador would be, and the Republicans don't agree. And it goes on and on. Of course, you have the Contras. The Democrats think that they're terrorists. And of course, for the Republicans, they're freedom fighters. And so you have no agreement on the definition of terrorism. And you have fascinating discussions between Democrats who want to know exactly how the executive branch would make those decisions. And the answer that they get all the time is that it would not be acceptable for the representative of the executive branch to guess what its department or what the executive branch would decide in the future. So they decide not to respond. And so there is basically no agreement on the material support of terrorism, because there is no agreement on the definition. And also, of course, because of civil liberties issues and freedom of speech issues about definition of what giving services to terrorists mean, what kind of expertise, what does it mean, everything. All those debates, of course, are still at the heart of the recent decision by the Supreme Court on the case Holder versus Humanitarian Law Project that was decided in 2010, 2 years ago. And it is, of course, because there is now material support for terrorism statute. It was passed in 1996 and under Clinton. And one major reason why it was passed, there's political obvious reasons and context. It's just 1 year after the Oklahoma City bombing, and people want to act in Congress against terrorism. But the other major context is that the Cold War is over. And so there are no very clear conflicts where Democrats and Republicans could be in disagreement about who the terrorists are. And also the events in Ireland are over. That's also a big issue when we think today in terms of charities, and mostly Muslim charities, right? So that would be the other decision that the Supreme Court just reached, to actually not grant the appeal of the Holy Land Foundation a few weeks ago. At the time in the 90s, many Irish Americans are giving money to Irish charities. And everyone knows that these are fronts and that they go to the IRA, meaning to terrorists. And you have, in fact, Margaret Thatcher is always complaining at the time that there is no extradition agreement between the U.S. and Great Britain, and that the U.S. is helping the terrorists over there and everything. All of this is pretty much gone in 96, and all the terrorists, quote unquote, that are left are in the Middle East. This is the conflict about the conflict, plural, about which there is agreement between Democrats and Republicans. So in that sense, there's a big hurdle that's out of the way. And this, to me, explains to a great extent how the material support of terrorism law got passed. And of course, it applies only to designated foreign terrorist organizations, not to all terrorists, right? And recently, there was the big issue of the MEK. They have been just delisted. And it had become problematic because it had been on the list of terrorist groups for many, many years. And George Bush himself in 2003, when making the case for the war in Iraq, had mentioned the fact that Saddam Hussein was hosting the MEK. And so that was part of the fact that he was part of the terrorist threat and linked to Al-Qaeda, broadly speaking. Recently, Democrats and Republicans officials from both parties had been talking to the MEK and talking for the MEK, and calling for delisting of the this organization. And the State Department recently actually took the MEK out of the list. And of course, if you look at, and those officials got money from the AEK to speak in their favor and to get them delisted. And if you look at the Holder versus Humanitarian Law Project decision, there is material support if there is coordination or control between the people who are giving the support and the group. And in that case, there was control. There was even money being exchanged. And so the way that problem gets solved is by delisting the MEK. And of course, the MEK is opposed to Iran and might have been involved in the assassination of various nuclear scientists in Iran. We don't know very well. Might probably have done that with Israeli help and support. We don't know exactly. So they get that the solution is obvious. They get delisted. But again, if we imagine for a second that I hope, obviously, that this is not going to happen. But if troubles in Ireland started again, and suddenly the U.S. would be left with laws that many, many, many American citizens would be troubled with because of what it does to the civil liberties and free speech, Irish Americans would be irate, would be really angry that they cannot give any money to any charity because somehow, as the Supreme Court decided, money is fungible, meaning that even if you give it to the humanitarian group, it is fungible, meaning that it frees space for you to fund your terrorism. If that standard was applied to groups that we want to help, the ANC in the 80s, the IRA for Irish Americans, the Mujahideen in the 80s, right? The Contras in the 80s, obviously there would be an uproar and people would realize that this is impossible. The problem right now is that everyone apparently agrees on who the terrorists are and they're all located in the Middle East. So the issue of terrorism and the definition of terrorism doesn't strike anyone as being a problem.
And that, I thought, was an excellent summary of how this word terrorism and the power to delist organizations, how that once it's been institutionalized, it becomes a bargaining chip. It's a power card that the State Department can play. How difficult it is for this set of institutions to play double, treble, quadruple game, how it can claim moral high ground, and yet it can reject moral equivalency. So it says, we are different from the terrorists. We have the legal monopoly on violence. And no, nothing we do is terrorism because we are a legal government. We are the good guys. I think thinking of oneself as a good guy, in some sense, it's psychologically inevitable. But thinking of other people as therefore bad guys, well, we're back to this idea. Are other people there intrinsically in opposition to oneself, or is the possibility that we're working together? Now, for a personal rather than an organizational look at the power of enemy images to corrupt and confuse objective thoughts about reality, I'd like you to compare the tales told about two young men. It's not quite a fair comparison. The second one, John Perkins, is telling his own story, but we begin with Douglas Valentine, from whom we heard last week, speaking on the corruption of the CIA, how if you reject moral equivalency and say we're the good guys, everything we do is good because we're fighting the bad guys, the problems that that entails. I thought we were going to have time for a lot of this, but in fact we've only got time for about 15 minutes because I want to contrast Bruce Lawler's development with that of John Perkins. So here goes. This is taken from episode 359 of Guns and Butter. As usual, I shall link to the original from this show's webpage. Many thanks to Bonnie Faulkner for providing this clip.
In your new book, The CIA as Organized Crime, How Illegal Operations Corrupt America and the World, You've written that the collusion between crime and law enforcement is the glue that holds the system together. You say that this is the case for small towns all the way up to the federal government. How does this system of collusion between crime and law enforcement operate? And why is this the case? You asked the question, is having people who are in actuality war criminals in positions of legislative and executive authority in America an expression of a free society? What are some examples of war criminals in positions of authority in America? For example, Major General Bruce Lawler. You wrote a chapter on him. Who is he?
Well, when I was doing my research in my book, The Phoenix Program, I met a bunch of CIA officers, and they told me what they did. And Bruce Lawler was one of them. And he was a guy that he was going to college in Washington, D.C., and he got recruited into the CIA. This was during the Vietnam War. And he was sent for training. He learned how to be both an agent handler, which is a specific job description in the CIA. There's agent handlers, but he also learned how to be a paramilitary officer, which are people that shoot guns and blow things up, and organize paramilitary units in foreign countries. And then around 1970, he was sent over, 71, he was sent over to Vietnam to work for more senior CIA officers doing these things. One of his jobs as a liaison officer was working with what was called the special branch of the South Vietnamese police. They are sort of comparable to our FBI, the special branch of the police. They were involved in trying to penetrate the insurgency at the highest levels. The Viet Cong insurgency had a political apparatus. You could think of them as the Democrats and the Americans and their allies as the Republicans, and the CIA and its allies and the special police and the South Vietnamese army and its politicians were like Republicans, and they could not tolerate anybody who was a communist. They were after trying to find all the Democrats, all the communists in South Vietnam, and they would penetrate that organization through informants and also secret agents who would become part of it. They weren't really all that interested necessarily in arresting these people, but they were interested in being able to manipulate them to be able to say, well, we know where your family lives. If you're not good, we'll go bump off your family. So because in Vietnam, for example, all the communists knew who the special policemen were and where their families were. So you couldn't go around bumping off each other's families, or you'd have like with the mafia, there was, you don't kill another man's wife and kids, you just keep it with yourself. So that was sort of like a rule. Anyway, Lawler found himself as a very young man, maybe 24, 25 years old, in a very important position. He was a liaison to a special police officer, and that special police officer ran an interrogation center where people who were suspected of having ties to the communists were brought for interrogation. And his job was to be there and to watch what would happen and report on it back to his bosses. And when I was talking with Lawler, he was very upset about the things he saw and about how his bosses behaved. It's now into 1972, 73. There's been a ceasefire signed, and supposedly the war has stopped. And yet these kind of very, devious and deadly kind of assassinations and interrogations and torture were still going on, and they weren't supposed to be going on anymore. And Lawler was very upset. One day he walked into this interrogation center, and there was a woman laid out on a table, and she'd been murdered and raped. And he saw that. you know, the special policeman had murdered this woman, and he was just stunned. He didn't know what to do. I mean, it's a crime. Obviously, it's a crime. And he reported it, and he was told, well, you know, forget about it. We can't control what the South Vietnamese do. Don't make an issue of it. Other things like that were happening to him, and he was witnessing his boss. And he explained all this to me. His boss was a very senior CIA officer, and he was in charge of Da Nang City, which is up in I Corps. And Bruce, through his Lawler, through his agent net, knew that this guy's girlfriend was a Viet Cong agent. And he went to his senior CIA boss and he said, look, I know your girlfriend's working for the enemy. And he told me, but they knew the war was winding down and they just wanted to live a good life. This CIA, old-time CIA guy, it was his last tour. He was going to retire. It wasn't uncommon in Vietnam for a senior, the Vietnamese special police, to actually bring a young 14, 15-year-old girl to a CIA officer every night. Different one. It's different culture. And these kinds of things and inducements were available. And when you're a CIA officer and everything you do is secret, you know, you don't have to put that into a report. And of course, because you're protected and nobody can ever bring you before court in the United States, you can do anything illegal you want and you can get away with it. And all it takes is an old boy network of each of these guys knowing that this is how it works and that, you know, all they have to do is cover for each other and they can get away with it. And they're getting away with it all over the world every day in a million ways. And that's how that old boy system works. But Bruce Lawler was only 24 years old, 25 years old, and he hadn't yet got assimilated into this old boy culture. And he actually went to the security officer in Saigon and reported about the rape and the murder of this woman and about his senior boss being involved in having a girlfriend who was, you know, part of the enemy infrastructure. And within a week, Bruce Lawler was sent home. So the security forces within the CIA, within the FBI, they don't exist to enforce rules or laws. They exist to enforce the old boy network and to allow these guys to get away with this. I mean, and if you, the worst thing that you can do, you know, ask somebody like Snowden or John Kiriakou. Kiriakou ended up spending a couple of years in prison because all he did was mention another CIA officer's name. The one thing you can't do in the CIA is, you know, rat out all the corruption that's going on. It's just like being in the NYPD. You can rip off people left and right all day long. The one thing you can't do is break the code of silence. And that's the same thing that's going on in the CIA. And that's why I said at the beginning of this conversation that if you're successful because you lie, steal, and cheat and murder, well, those become the things that you're going to use in the bureaucracy. And that's exactly what happens. But you can't know about it because these are secret organizations. And they're, you know, supposedly they're secret because they're doing all this good work overthrowing Russia or something, you know. But it's really just to preserve all the prerogatives and the freedoms that they have in the security services themselves or in the police force themselves. And they rationalize it by saying, well, we have to live these lives because we're on the front lines and we get very small paychecks and we have to supplement our incomes somehow. You know, a cop says, well, I can't send my kids to college on the paycheck I get. So if I want to send my kids to college, well, then I got to let the Jamaicans beat up the Colombians and take over the drug trade in my neighborhood, you know, and then because the drug trade is going to go on anyway. So I got to let somebody do it. So, you know, if somebody's going to give me some money, then I can send my kids to college. So all these things go into it. Anyway, at the same time, in order to become part of this old boy network, whether it's in the NYPD or the FBI or the CIA, as happened to Lawler. You have to give up a part of yourself. And Lawler went through all this training, and he really believed in fighting communism. And even though he got sent back home after reporting on all the corruption he saw, and even though they actually kicked him out of the CIA, there was a part of him that always longed to get back in. And a couple of years later, he actually went back down to Washington, D.C. Lawler's from Vermont. And he went to see William Colby, who was also brought up in Vermont. And Colby tried to get him back into the CIA, and it didn't really work. So he went back into the he'd been a reserve officer in the military, but he wanted to be part of this. So Colby helped him getting back into the military, and all of a sudden, through the 1990s, he started rising very quickly through the military, and by 1999. He was actually a general heading a special joint coordination force within NATO or something. I can't remember exactly, but he had given up his law practice and become a full-time military officer. He was a general. And when the Department of Homeland Security was created in 2001, Bruce Lawler became its chief of staff. And all of a sudden, you have a guy who's still trying to prove, whose personal motivation is to prove that he really is one of the old boys, that he's sorry that he ratted out all his bosses back there in Vietnam. Please give me a chance, and I'll show you guys that I'm really one of you. Now, he gets appointed chief of staff of the Department of Homeland Security when it's created. And all sorts of people were complaining about because they didn't understand what he was doing, and they couldn't understand why he was doing certain things. And I wrote him a letter. It was actually an open letter, which was published in Counterpunch about a week after he got appointed to this position. And I said, "Hey, Bruce, are you still working for the CIA? I mean, are you a CIA plant in the Department of Homeland Security? Are you actually working for them? And are you, you know, helping to organize this new organization in a way that makes it possible for the CIA to infiltrate them and to place people that it wants in positions of power there?" And of course, you know, that was, again, I didn't come up through the Columbia School of Journalism. You know, I mean, I just asked it. And of course, he never responded. But, you know, no, a guy like him could always be, even if he's not actually a CIA officer, so ideologically in sync with them and has the contacts, I mean, that he could actually be a CIA asset at the highest level of the Department of Homeland Security. And if you think it doesn't happen, think again, because it does happen. And there was an awful lot of people from the Phoenix program and from the CIA who moved out of the CIA, either into positions of to hold public office or into law enforcement or the DEA or the FBI or some other organization, who maintain their CIA contacts, come up through another channel and find themselves in the Department of Homeland Security. And certainly the ideology is there, and infects the whole thing of the only way we can get these bad guys is to be worse than them, to be more devious. And that's how crime and law enforcement become indistinguishable. And the tactics that are used in crime and law enforcement are exactly the same, except that one group wears the mantle of legitimacy, you know, and the other, you know, they're the immigrants or the outcasts who are just trying to get into the establishment, and they don't have lawyers writing tax laws, you know, to get them off of like a guy like Trump, you know, so he doesn't have to pay $1 billion in taxes that he owes, which of course is a much bigger crime than anything that the minions are doing, you know, that the nobodies are doing that are getting arrested and put in jail. You know, I mean, the massive crime is conducted systematically, like like I quote that fellow at the beginning of my book saying, the violence of guns is for the amateur. The violence of aircraft carrier fleets, of nuclear weapons, of the Department of Justice that's essentially racist. You know, that kind of violence, that kind of terror, that's the problems of our rulers. And it's all legal because they make it legal for them to do it. And yet it's no less criminal to be not paying $1 billion in taxes. Just as you're a billionaire, that's what you're allowed to do. Anyway, so I could go on and on with there's all sorts of in this book, the CIA organized trauma. Present a couple of cases of people who worked for the CIA or special forces and then carry this whole philosophy with them into their public life.
And thanks to Douglas Valentine for broadening the scope there. I haven't yet looked at the arms industry. I think that's got to be a serious omission by any stretch of the imagination if we look at the business of generating enemy images. Now, we're going to conclude with 5 minutes. This is a reading from John Perkins' hugely successful Confessions of an Economic Hitman. I find it, perhaps it's because I live in an LDC, a lesser developed country that's formerly underdeveloped, or just a poor country, very impressed by his ability to tie together several different topics and coherently explain that to a Western audience. He's describing a point in his life in the 1970s, early 1970s, when already he's hearing predictions of a coming global war between the Christian and the Muslim states. So that is a perspective we haven't yet heard on this war on terrorism, and ties that together with colonial exploitation, as well as giving us something of an inside perspective, how it feels to be involved in a massive enterprise, the foreign aid business, and yet at the same time be a human being and having to deal with a moral conscience that won't be confined to the simplistic images of improving people's lives by allowing them to generate more exports.
I began to wonder when foreign aid is genuine and when it is only greedy and self-serving. Indeed, I began to question whether such aid is ever altruistic, and if not, whether that could be changed. I was certain that countries like my own should take decisive action to help the sick and starving of the world, but I was equally certain that this was seldom, if ever, the prime motivation for our intervention. I kept coming back to one main question. If the objective of foreign aid is imperialism, is that so wrong? I often found myself envying people like Charlie, who believe so strongly in our system that they wanted to force it on the rest of the world. I doubted whether limited resources would allow the whole world to live the opulent life of the United States, when even the United States had millions of citizens living in poverty. In addition, it wasn't entirely clear to me that people in other nations actually want to live like us. Our own statistics about violence, depression, drug abuse, divorce, and crime indicated that although ours was one of the wealthiest societies in history, it may also be one of the least happy societies. Why would we want others to emulate us? Perhaps Claudine had warned me of all this. I was no longer sure what it was she had been trying to tell me. In any case, intellectual arguments aside, it had now become painfully clear that my days of innocence were gone. I wrote in my journal, "Is anyone in the U.S. innocent? Although those at the very pinnacle of the economic pyramid gain the most, millions of us depend, either directly or indirectly, on the exploitation of the LDCs for our livelihoods. The resources and cheap labor that feed nearly all our businesses come from places like Indonesia, and very little ever makes its way back. The loans of foreign aid ensure that today's children and their grandchildren will be held hostage. They will have to allow our corporations to ravage their natural resources, and will have to forego education, health, and other social services merely to pay us back. the fact that our own companies already received most of this money to build the power plants, airports, and industrial parks, does not factor into this formula. Does the excuse that most Americans are unaware of this constitute innocence? Uninformed and intentionally misinformed, yes, but innocent? Of course, I had to face the fact that I was now numbered among those who actively misinform. The concept of a worldwide holy war was a disturbing one, but the longer I contemplated it, the more convinced I became of its possibility. It seemed to me, however, that if this jihad were to occur, it would be less about Muslims versus Christians than it would be about LDCs versus DCs, perhaps with Muslims at the forefront. We in the DCs were the users of resources, those in the LDCs were the suppliers. It was the colonial mercantile system all over again, set up to make it easy for those with power and limited natural resources to exploit those with resources but no power. I did not have a copy of Toynbee with me, but I knew enough history to understand that suppliers who are exploited long enough will rebel. I only had to return to the American Revolution and Tom Paine for a model. I recalled that Britain justified its taxes by claiming that England was providing aid to the colonies in the form of military protection against the French and the Indians. The colonists had a very different interpretation. What Paine offered to his countrymen in the brilliant Common Sense was the soul that my young Indonesian friends had referred to, an idea, a faith in the justice of a higher power, and a religion of freedom and equality that was diametrically opposed to the British monarchy and its elitist class systems. What Muslims offered was similar, faith in a higher power and a belief that developed countries have no right to subjugate and exploit the rest of the world. Like colonial Minutemen, Muslims were threatening to fight for their rights. And, like the British in the 1770s, we classified such actions as terrorism. History appeared to be repeating itself. I wondered what sort of a world we might have if the United States and its allies diverted all the monies expended in colonial wars, like the one in Vietnam, to eradicating world hunger, or to making education and basic health care available to all people, including our own. I wondered how future generations would be affected if we committed to alleviating the sources of misery and to protecting watersheds, forests, and other natural areas that ensure clean water, air, and the things that feed our spirits as well as our bodies. I could not believe that our founding fathers had envisioned the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness to exist only for Americans. So why were we now implementing strategies that promoted the imperialist values they had fought against? I take it my way, my shiny black
fist. I treat horses. And yes, I confess I also chose that because I wanted to end the show on a positive note. I feel like my life has improved a lot since I've concentrated on trying to cut down on enemy images. Slightly like I felt my life improved when I gave up watching television. I guess it's kind of a question of mental hygiene. I hope the show has helped you to see that the word terrorism is one that, if we must use it, I only use this word on WikiSpooks within double quotes now. I don't talk about terrorists of my own volition. Whatever people do, they are still people. If we're committing crimes, these people could be criminals. Do we really need to have a separate fear-based category where different rules apply? This and all previous episodes of the show are available for download from an MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Every episode has its own page describing the contributors, and there's a couple of hundred contributor pages listing all the episodes to which they've made a contribution. I'm always glad to hear what you think of the show. And special thanks to John Hettinger for getting in touch after listening for many years. I was encouraged to hear his appreciation of the show. Listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio. Time of Useful Consciousness. Dismantling Corporations. This is the second of a four-part tribute to Richard Grossman, who Ralph Nader called the preeminent historian of corporations. Richard died of cancer on November 22, 2011. He was only 68. I see him as one of the lucid people who first described not just the history of corporations, but the now global challenge to democracy and personal and state sovereignty that they pose. In the preface to his 1993 pamphlet, Taking Care of Business, Richard wrote, "Corporations cause harm every day. Why do their harms go unchecked? How can they dictate what we produce, how we work, what we eat, drink, and breathe? How did a self-governing people let this come to pass? Corporations were not supposed to reign in the United States." End quote. Dave Henson was co-founder with Richard Grossman of the Project on Corporations, Law, and Democracy. He wrote, "I hear the direct and indirect influence of Richard Grossman every day in the Occupy movement. I'm sure he had quite a critique of everything Occupy, but I know he must have relished in the increasingly widespread conscious dissent he has helped instigate." End quote. For a sense of how early Richard Grossman formed his analysis, how long it took for his ideas to be accepted or even known, here's a speech he gave in Washington, D.C. at the 1996 teach-in organized by the International Forum on Globalization.
In the year 1407, the good sovereign king Henry IV of England chartered the Company of Merchant and Adventurers, the ancestor of the East India Company, granting it monopoly control over exports of certain manufactures. The empire started to expand, wealth began to flow into England. In 1553, the crown chartered the Russian Company, granting monopoly privilege over certain trade routes to Russia. The company also got special concessions from the Tsar. In 1553, the Africa Company was chartered, as given special privileges to pursue the slave trade. In 1557, the Spanish Company was chartered, given special privileges and monopolies to control the wine and olive oil trade with Spain and Portugal. In 1578, the Eastland Company was created, given sole privilege to carry on trade with Scandinavian countries. It was also granted additional authority to make laws, impose fines, and imprison people. In 1581, the Levant Company was created to trade with Turkey. In 1592, this company merged with the Turkey Company and the Venice Company, in which Queen Elizabeth was a shareholder, to form the East India Company. In 1605, the East India Company was given a charter in perpetuity and given exclusive rights to trade in specified areas of Europe, East and West Asia, North and West Africa. What was the purpose of these and other global corporations of those days, these chips off the old block of sovereignty? Well, in hindsight, we can be very clear that their mission was to buy cheap, to sell dear, to limit or prevent competition, to vacuum out resources, to display fierce violence and to perpetuate violence to people, species, and places, to destroy existing cultures and social relationships, to replace independence with dependence, to eradicate people's sense of their own histories, to get people to internalize the corporation's values, myths, and worldviews, to create a class of bureaucrats and civil servants to serve their needs, to define people as subjects, objects, property, invisible, or anything else they wanted to define them as, to control all dispute resolution, to raise armies and navies and wage war, to write laws, including laws and doctrines, which legalize and institutionalize the corporation's destructive and dominating acts, to enforce laws, to impose punishments, including executions. In other words, to govern, and to govern dictatorially, but with guile. From these hundreds of years of experiences, can't we deduce the nature of the corporate fiction? These corporations didn't just create some excessive harms. They didn't just occasionally exploit. They didn't just drive bargains. They were, by definition, by their nature, oppressors. It's an old story, isn't it? The cults of the few tyrannizing the many. And the many, what about them? Who were they? They were the violated and the dehumanized, the oppressed, the people blocked from being and acting fully human, from participating in their own governance, from defining their own lives, their own work, their own values. Today, the majority of the people in the world are oppressed by the few, and the oppressive vehicle of choice is, guess what? The global corporation. So isn't it time that we started acting like oppressed people? Well, the question is, what kind of oppressed people? The conscious oppressed people or the unconscious oppressed people? Here are some characteristics of the unconscious oppressed people, which I've stolen from Paulo Freire. They believe that the oppressor is the model of humanity. They adopt the oppressor's values. They aspire to be like the most eminent and respectable of the oppressors. They are drawn by the irresistible attraction to the oppressor's way of life, thereby modeling their civic, educational, and other institutions after the oppressor's institutions. They accept the dominance and authority of the oppressors as just and appropriate or as inevitable. They concede to the oppressor basic legal and cultural authority to define investment, production, and work, and to define values and concepts such as progress, efficiency, productivity, sustainability, legal violence, justice, freedom, human rights, liberty, nature, security, property, prosperity, peace, public, private, and personhood. They allow, even encourage, oppressors to educate and entertain their children. They fear governing themselves. They fear to define their own societies. They do not know their own history. They think and talk and strategize in the language of the oppressors. They pursue their grievances only in the dens of the oppressors. They confuse freedom with the maintenance of the status quo. And what about the conscious oppressed? Well, there are people in the process of moving, of uncovering their own histories, especially by examining events and eras glorified or distorted by the oppressors. They're relearning their languages and their culture. They're realizing how naive they have been. They're coming to see their oppression as a distortion of being fully human. That to permit themselves to be treated as objects, as property, as subjects, as invisible, to permit one's community to be treated as a fiefdom, is nuts. Who are joining to help each other to stop regarding the oppressors as abstract forces, as created by God or Mother Nature, who are confronting their realities analytically, teaching themselves by investigations and intentional discussions and authentic action, not merely to curb the worst excesses of the oppressors, but to craft resistance, which is about taking power and legitimacy from the oppressors, and by assuming the authority to govern themselves. who see freedom not just as a gift or as an endowment, but as a process by which they can aspire to create institutions of self-governance, and that they can maintain these institutions by acting responsibly and accountably to one another, who are impatient and also patient. That's the kind of oppressed people that we need to be. And I think as a result of the efforts and struggles versus tyranny and for consciousness of people around the globe, across the centuries and centuries and in recent times, that that's the people who we are becoming. In Freire's words, we're moving toward the historical process as responsible subjects, not as objects, who can work with one another not to grovel for concessions or fawn over the false generosity of the oppressors, but to transform our world. So what does this mean for us today? Well, we have some models that we can use as guides. The triumph of the majority of the people in South Africa, the triumph of the Indian people in India, our own American Revolution. But for each of these events and processes, it's important that we look to see what happened and what didn't happen, just to re-examine the history. Let's look at the American Revolution. Well, actually, take a look at the South African Revolution. I learned the last time the IFG people were together from our colleague in South Africa that in the new South African Constitution, corporations are written in as citizens. Now, the American Revolution, what was it? One of the things it replaced a dictatorial oppressor with a very different idea, the idea of self-governance, and it sent the idea of the monarchy packing. And we transformed crown corporations, dictatorial crown corporations like the Massachusetts colony and the Virginia colony and the Carolina colony into constitutionalized states. What it was not self-governance and democracy for all. So that even though sovereignty passed from the king to the people by revolution, once again there was a minority cult tyrannizing the majority. Native people, African Americans, women, men without property, debtors, and the rest of the species and places. Given this great founding violence against humanity, it is logical that the institution of the tyrannizing minority would one day rule again. It didn't take long. Although the word corporation is not mentioned in the U.S. Constitution, although the minority who recognized themselves as people instituted mechanisms to define and limit the corporation with precision, to keep it from political rights and power, by the end of the 19th century, the corporation had waged a counter-revolution, had transformed the laws, and was on its way to becoming, to being, what corporations had been revealed as for the previous 300 years. With the wealth and power, they constitutionalized corporate rights and authority over property and over the decision-making of what counts. In other words, they became able to act as legal persons and created the fiction of the market, where investment, production, and work decision-making, the basic decision-making that shape our lives and our communities, were declared beyond the authority of the people. So that even when the excluded classes of people, African Americans, Native people, women, men without property, after a century of struggle, had become people, had won their rights, the corporations and the culture were powerful enough, the corporate culture was powerful enough to transform all of us into consumers. I go through this because it's vital in our road to consciousness and in our engaging and authentic action to understand that what corporations are now doing around the world, they accomplished in the United States of America 100 years ago. And what they have been perfecting all through this century in this country is what they are seeking to do globally today. What else is GATT or NAFTA, the Multilateral Agreement on Investments, but the logical next step to constitutionalize the corporation everywhere, through guile to legalize the property rights of corporations over everything that really counts? Given this reality and given this history, we need to ask ourselves critically, what is the nature of our alleged democracy in this country today? Can we say that we have a democracy? Can we say that we, the people, are politically free, that we govern ourselves when corporate fictions not only wield power and authority under law, but they also have oppressed so many people into unconsciousness? When we gather to talk about our goals, how can we gather to teach each other to meet as political equals, as aspiring to nothing less than political freedom. To recognize today that today the giant corporation is illegitimate, that we must not concede to the corporation any authority, that we must understand how they have colonized our minds, lowered our aspirations, confused us about who we are and what we can be. The late 19th century populists refused to concede to the corporation authority over their lives. They refused to concede that the corporation, this artificial entity created by the people, would become the dominant institution of society. They understood that if the corporation has turned the law around and the culture around so that property rights are greater than human rights, there can be no such thing as self-governance. But that was the last social movement to be so conscious, to be so clear. The progressives, the New Deal, and ever since, our citizen movements essentially have conceded corporate power, basic power and privilege and authority to the corporation, to this form of property. Most citizen efforts have been to tinker with corporate behavior at the margins, not to address their nature. We've tried to curb corporate excesses to perfect the market. Most efforts against corporations in this century have been against the symptoms of corporate domination, and they have taken place in the dens created by corporations to absorb our time and energy, regulatory administrative agencies, and the corporate press. But these are not the arenas of sovereignty, of citizen authority, of our political freedom. Given the constitutional rights which federal courts have given the corporations, and given our powerful corporate culture, these realms are stack deck proceedings where people, communities, and nature are fundamentally disadvantaged. Here we cannot demand, by what authority has Corporation X acted as an oppressor of the sovereign people? Here we cannot declare a corporation beyond its authority and declare it null and void and dismantle it. We must grapple with the reality that today our law and culture concede sovereignty to these artificial entities called corporations. And we must grapple with the fact that so do most of our own citizen organizations, our organizations created to bring about justice and environmental protection and protect worker rights and human rights. So we endlessly tally corporate acts, we analyze the regulatory agencies, we become expert in every issue under the sun. But we don't study who we the people are and how we got into this mess and how it is our responsibility to free ourselves so that we can define all the corporate bodies that we create, business, government, civic, education. We've been resisting corporate assaults one at a time after the fact and over and over and over again. It's enough. It's time to build a cosmic democracy movement, a movement for political rights and for real self-government. It's time for us to be socially responsible. It's time for us to be accountable. But we are not accountable or responsible when we create these monster robots which run rampant in our communities and which in our name sally forth across the world to wreak havoc upon other places and upon other people's self-governance. We are not being socially responsible or civically accountable when we don't act like self-governing people. We are not being socially responsible or civically accountable when we play in the corporate arenas and obey corporate rules. We are not being socially responsible or civically accountable when we permit our agents in government to bestow our sovereignty upon machines. We're not being socially responsible or civically accountable when we organize our communities and then go to corporate executives and to the hacks who run the corporate front groups and ask them, please, please cause a little less harm, or when we offer them even more rewards for being a little less dominating and oppressing. Sovereign people do not beg of or negotiate with the subordinate entities that we create. Sovereign people, self-governing people, instruct subordinate entities. Self-governing people define all the entities we create. And when a subordinate entity violates the terms of its creation and undermines our ability to govern ourselves and violates the fundamentals of a body politic, we are required to move in responsibly and accountably to cut this cancer out of the body politic. We make all our struggles for justice and democracy here and around the world easier by weakening the ability of corporations to make the rules, to set the culture, and to oppress us. With such deeds, will we honor the millions of people who struggled before us to wrest power from tyrants and to define themselves in the face of terror and oppression. Thank you.
That was Richard Grossman, recorded in Washington, D.C. at the 1996 teach-in organized by the International Forum on Globalization. This is a tribute to his still largely unknown work, which had died on November 22, 2011. He lived with his wife, Mary MacArthur, in a small town in the Catskills in New York State. His lasting legacy is the pamphlet Taking Care of Business, written with contribution by Frank Adams, published in 1993. In that pamphlet, Grossman laid out for the first time the history, subversion, and the taking back of the process of chartering corporations. Grossman wrote, "When we look at the history of our states, we learn that citizens intentionally defined corporations through charters. In exchange for the charter, a corporation was obligated to obey all laws, to serve the common good, and to cause no harm. Early state legislators wrote charter laws to limit corporate authority and to ensure that when a corporation caused harm, they could revoke its charter. Corporations may have taken our political power, but they have not taken our constitutional sovereignty. Citizens are guaranteed sovereign authority over government officeholders. Every state still has legal authority to grant and to revoke corporate charters. Corporations, large or small, still must obey all laws, serve the common good, and cause no harm. To exercise our sovereign authority over corporations, we must take back our political authority over our state governments. Our right to charter corporations is as crucial to self-government as our right to vote. Both are basic franchises, essential tools of liberty." End quote from Taking Care of Business by Richard Grossman, a slender pocketbook of 32 pages filled with practical advice, bibliography, and footnotes. The booklet is out of print. A link to the text on Dave Radcliffe's website is on tucradio.org. It is an amazingly timely resource. There are two important projects that Richard Grossman initiated in the last months of his life that do not receive enough notice in the obituaries about his work. Upstate New York, where he lived in a small town, is in the crosshairs of natural gas exploration and hydrofracking. Fracking involves injecting highly toxic chemicals deep underground to fracture rock formations to force out the gas. Fracking has been linked to over 1,000 incidents of groundwater contamination across the U.S., including many cases where people can actually set their tap water on fire. The process is currently unregulated due to exemptions in law. Richard Grossman became active in the Sovereign People's Action Network, SPAN. He presented at the August 2011 Greenfest in New York City the draft of a law to not just regulate or limit the practice, but to formally criminalize the procedure. The draft of this criminalized fracking law is an amendment to the Penal Code and dated August 2011. A link to this draft is posted on the newest programs page of TUC Radio's website. The second legacy of Richard Grossman's work that he formalized as draft just 4 weeks before he died is an act to criminalize chartered incorporated business entities as a class or group. Several obituaries refer to that act by name without offering a link to the text. It seems as if those who want to remember Richard Grossman shy away from presenting his most radical proposal. But Richard himself wanted it to be seen. It is his contribution to the Occupy movement. He sent an email with a draft, with permission to share, to friends and colleagues just a few weeks before he died. TUC Radio and I received it on October 23, 2011. It said, "Autumnal greetings, Mariah. I sent this around the other week. If you can help spread, I'd much appreciate it." His cover letter said, "At Wall Street and other occupations, there's much talk of greed and corruption. Historical, constitutional, and legal analyses, as well as evaluations of past people's strategies and organizings, are skimpy. For people prepared to move beyond greed and corruption, see below an act to criminalize chartered incorporated business entities. Why not target USA and state law that has long enabled minority rule, that has constitutionalized violence against peoples and the earth? Could be energizing, keeping in mind, of course, that there is no quick fix, so we'll have to be creative, persistent. Feel free to circulate. The time is ripe. Good luck to us all and to the earth. In solidarity, Richard." That was the cover for Richard Grossman's email that I received 4 weeks before he died. The act to criminalize chartered incorporated business entities is a passionate, learned, and moving provocation. Setting July 4th, 2012 as date, it says that on that day, quote, "All existing business corporation charters granted by the United States and by all states shall be null and void." And on that same date, owners of stock in previously incorporated business entities and entity directors and executive officers shall forever be liable for all debts, liabilities, assaults, denials, harms, invasions, and usurpations committed by any and all successor business entities," end quote. There's more specific formal legal language that is too difficult to read on air. However, the attached notes form the essence of Richard Grossman's thinking and are his legacy to the movements for self-governance and occupation that began in 2011. That was a tribute to some of Richard Grossman's work. He died of cancer on November 22, 2011. In the last 15 years, he had been an important member of POCLAD, the Project on Corporations, Law and Democracy, and CELDEF, the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. For links to the texts mentioned in this program, come to www.tucradio.org. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get information on how to order a CD of Richard Grossman on Dismantling Corporations by calling 1-707-463-2654. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation or CD order keeps this program on the air. Call anytime at 707-463-2654 for information on how to order. You can get your CD by mail or credit card by phone or online on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. My name is Mariah Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.
This is the Theta Report, CIUT 89.5 FM, and I think we are joined by Rick Sterling. Are you there, Rick?
Yeah, hi, Phil.
Thank you very much, Rick, for talking to us. You've written a very good piece. I saw it at the Duran. I know that people just write Rick Sterling, and you can find this piece. Rick is an investigative journalist, and he's with the Syria Solidarity Movement. You've written about this matter, which it's like now a few days goes by, and it's almost like so many things have happened. The U.S. government struck Syria with 59 missiles because they said the government of Syria had used chemical weapons against beautiful babies, and right. The president's daughter had been disturbed at seeing the pictures.
Right.
And therefore it was necessary to give the word to fire missiles at another sovereign country and then to describe that rather Nero-like while talking about chocolate cake. This is, to me, a maddening situation. Your article clarifies the matter. It starts with this alarm and this rush to attack, which, by the way, Canada endorsed the attack after first saying there should be an investigation. Has there been any investigation? Does anybody actually know what happened on April the 4th for sure?
No, there's been no on-the-ground investigation. There's been a number of careful reviews of the video. The Guardian out of London sent a reporter in there just a day or two after the event, and they claimed that was an investigation and but it was very limited, and they had photographs of one of the strikes, but then the author of that report talked about four strikes. Well, where are the other three buildings that were damaged supposedly?
Mm-hmm.
So it was very unconvincing. It was not a serious investigation, and that hasn't happened yet. And both Syria's called for an impartial, independent investigation, and so has Russia. It's the U.S. that said, well, we know what happened, and presumably we don't need an investigation because we already know who's guilty, and that's that.
We don't need any stinking badges. This is Rick Sterling. I should have read the title because it's a very important title, The Escalating War on Syria and the Need for International Law. Now, there is international law, but you point out that the U.S. has a kind of a little shell game they call humanitarian law.
Right, right.
Which contributes to this kind of a mess. What's missing here?
Well, unfortunately, international law has been completely subverted and sidelined and ignored. And it's been kind of replaced. I'd like to do some research and really document this, but in the late 1990s and early 2000s, international law was effectively replaced by something called humanitarian law. And so you had groups
and you say
like,
something because it's kind of hard to define that thing, isn't it?
Well, no, they have specific rules. You're not allowed to, intentionally kill civilians and things
this,
like that.
This is chapter 7 versus chapter 6.
Well, the big difference is that international law is very clear that you're not allowed to attack another country unless that country has attacked you or unless you have the authorization of the UN Security Council.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the only two ways a country can attack another country, as the U.S. did on April 6th.
Mm-hmm.
But that has been subverted. All of the wars of the last, the invasion of Iraq, and even going back to the early 1990 when the U.S. Attacked Iraq after Iraq invaded and intervened in Kuwait, there's been a humanitarian pretext to it. So in that case, you had a marketing company that fabricated this scene where there were supposedly babies taken out of incubators, with the incubators stolen and taken back to Iraq, and the babies left on the floor. So that
by the way, there was a president's wife got involved. I remember Bush saying, my wife was so upset when she saw that testimony.
Oh, yeah, exactly. There were tears.
It turned out
the nurse who was testifying in Congress and bringing congressional representatives to tears, turned out the so-called nurse was actually the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador, and she'd actually only been to Kuwait a couple of times. She grew up in Washington, D.C., basically.
She's probably still there.
And then you had Colin Powell's persuasive performance at the U.N. Security Council in early 2003, and the Western media immediately said, well, that's a slam dunk. It's clear as a bell. Obviously, Saddam has weapons of mass destruction, and let's go attack them. And so the U.S. launched Shock and Awe. Mm-hmm. And more or less a million Iraqi dead later, we've got the emergence of ISIS and the destabilization of the Middle East. Mm-hmm. You had Libya in 2011. Syria has been ongoing since March of 2011. And it's quite similar to the Contra conflict that mm-hmm. happened in the 1980s, where the U.S. sponsored a proxy army to attack a sovereign country that they wanted to overthrow the government of, except it's multiplied by 100. This time around, it's not just the U.S. It's the U.S. plus all the wealthy Gulf monarchies. It's with France, the U.K., mm-hmm. with all Western Europe, basically, and Canada is in there as well. Mm-hmm. So you've had hundreds of Canadians recruited to join ISIS and Nusra and other terrorist groups and kill and be killed. Mm-hmm. And there's hundreds of Canadians. There's thousands and tens of thousands of French, Belgian, and UK citizens have been recruited to fight against the Syrian government, basically to join a jihadi army. Mm-hmm. It's really horrendous what's going on there. And then this is the latest, like when the news came out about the chemical weapons incident, immediately there was a flood of media reports. That's one thing the so-called moderate rebels are really good at. Mm-hmm. Flooding the social media with videos. Mm-hmm. They're really good at that for a reason, because they've been trained and supplied and equipped by the U.S. and by the U.K. and other groups. Literally, they've been trained and equipped and supplied with the video cameras and everything else. Mm-hmm. Hillary Clinton brags about it in her book, mm-hmm. Hard Choices.
The White Helmet sponsor guy with all that money, they arranged also public relations work.
Exactly. So it's soft power. And so when it came out, I mean, the logical question is, well, who's going to benefit from this? Well, it's the worst thing in the world for the Syrian government. It's the best thing in the world. The attack there, of course, the opposition blamed the Syrian government, and Trump used that as a pretext to attack Syria. Mm-hmm. What's going on at the deeper level? If I can I give you my analysis
Please
of what's
do.
Happening at the That's deeper
what,
level?
You
what
bet.
Basically, Trump campaigned on all these horrible policies regarding education and social policies were very, very much against the public interest, against social programs, reducing taxes and on the wealthy and so on and so forth. But he had one good thing, which he said he wanted to get away from the U.S. regime change foreign policy.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to reduce tensions with Russia. Who benefits from having all of this war and bloodshed? And look at what happened to in Iraq and Libya. And he was saying this. This isn't me. This is what he was saying.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the deep, there really is a deep state. Mm-hmm. And, whatever label you give to it, these are the CIA, the elements of the Department of Defense, the elements mm-hmm. in the military-industrial complex, the elements in the security apparatus, they have had control of U.S. foreign policy for a long, long time, and they're not about to see some, mm-hmm. Egomaniac real estate developer come in and change all that. So you've had an intense media campaign assault against Trump. All of the neocons were for Hillary Clinton. Robert Kagan, all of the standard neocons, and you even had official representatives of the CIA writing letters endorsing Clinton and saying Trump wasn't acceptable.
Yeah, 90% of newspapers.
Exactly. So then after Trump became president, the assault went into high gear, and now they've flipped him. Now he's on his knees, and he's basically reversed his policy. Now it's regime changed all the way. Now he's attacked Syria. On Tuesday, April 4th, the incident happened in Khan Sheikhoun, Syria. 2 days later, the next day, Trump changed his national security team. Bannon was out. McMaster took over. The next day, they attacked Syria. And the day after that, John McCain was gloating and saying how this is the best national security team he's seen, and Trump has seen the light.
Yes. They have people who now they call the nickname is Mad Dog, and they have important responsibilities. And right. The publishers and editors love these guys.
Well, and that's the sad thing. I mean, the Democrats have really disgraced themselves. They've shown themselves. They've instead of focusing on what was really bad about Trump's policies, they bought on to this anti-Russia, this Russia hysteria, mm-hmm. Which is absolute nonsense. I mean, if you want to look for a foreign country that has a lot of influence, undue influence in the U.S., look no further than Saudi Arabia and Israel. They're the ones who really control Washington and influence foreign policy.
And they've been openly embracing each other recently, and it's not
exactly.
A secret. It's not kept. But let's underline, you pointed out, we had the attack that almost led to a war in 2013, and it was shortly before the Geneva talks to solve this problem were to take place. Now, mm-hmm. This one happened similarly. There was a meeting due in Brussels.
Right, the day before, And these spectacular atrocities that are always blamed on the Assad government, the timing of them is always advantageous to the opposition.
Mm-hmm.
One just has to look at the context, and then. But if you mm-hmm. want to really prove it, which group was it, and which foreign power were they allied with? That takes some serious investigation. Ultimately, it'll come out like it did 2013. Immediately, the Western media blamed Assad, and the pressure was on Obama to launch an attack on Syria.
Do something.
Do something, exactly. And it's the same thing this time, except all the greater.
Yes.
And so they flipped Trump on this. He's reversed his policy. And now, instead of being in the doghouse, he's president. Now he's presidential.
Yeah, a Globe and Mail editorial or op-ed man wrote, "Finally, the adults have taken over the White House."
Wow.
So
well,
the adults.
Yeah.
We've attacked somebody, a sovereign country, risking nuclear war. Now that's a sign we've got the adults running the place.
Yeah.
By the way, speaking of an adult who let us all down, but I'm really glad you mentioned him in the article. Noam Chomsky, by the way, we've known this for a long time. He goes out of his way to sideswipe countries that are under duress from the U.S. He did it to Libya. And in this case, he's done it with Syria.
Yeah.
And you pointed out, there's a lot of problems with it. He seems to be – people think of him as an anarchist. He seems to be a crank Democrat. He always votes Democrat. I don't know why people haven't noticed, but thank you for talking about him. Please tell us, review what your thoughts are about him.
Well, it's not just Noam Chomsky. It's the progressive, the left across the West has failed dismally. Their analysis of Syria has just been terribly mistaken, and it's basically demobilized the resistance and the opposition to the war. So many people have heard so many times Bashar al-Assad is a brutal dictator. The atrocities, they target hospitals, they target civilians, they kill in marketplaces, they torture here, left, right, center, thousands of civilians. I've looked into these cases, and they're put forward by Doctors Without Borders. They're put forward by Amnesty. Obviously, evidently, Noam Chomsky believes them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've looked into these cases, Bill, a lot of examples. I've written many articles examining them one by one, and you find out that it's almost always based on hearsay reports from people who are paid by the opposition who are in Turkey,
mm-hmm.
believe it or not.
Yes.
That is the reality. So we're at a point where what Hillary Clinton talked about is soft power. She was talking about that, and Samantha Powers, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., talked a lot about soft power. One of the elements of soft power is you get these big multi-million dollar NGOs attacking a government that is in the sights of the U.S., whether it was Libya or now it's Syria. Russia is demonized daily. But if we talk about Syria, the truth about Syria, I mean, I've been to Syria a couple of times. I've studied it intensely for years now, and I've followed U.S. imperialism as well and its sidekick Canada for many decades. It's really Assad, if you look at interviews with him, if you look at the work he's done, if you look at the policies he's carried out, Assad is an intelligent, he's a calm, he's a careful, he's a courageous leader. Many years ago, they were all predicting, when is Assad going to take his family and flee? When is he going to go back to London, where he was doing his ophthalmology work? No. I mean, basically, it's the big lie. And it's really important that progressives ask for the evidence. Well, why are you saying he's a brutal dictator? And we can, and then you've got to look into the examples that are cited. But in my research, and from talking with a lot of people in Syria, and these are not, I'm not just talking to Syrian government supporters. I'm talking to all sorts of people. Some of them are quite hostile to the Ba'ath Party. But across the board, they are supportive of the Syrian state, the Syrian army that's defending their secular government.
And it's so important. We just went through Easter, where we see the Christians in Damascus and Aleppo going about their business and practicing their faith. And here we have an opponent which says we're going to burn them out of the country. And West talks about, always brings in Christianity. It's only against the government which protects the all the religious faiths of Syria. It's amazing. On that point about Assad and his personnel, you know, I noticed that they rather hold back the amount of times they let him be shown, because, you know, I assume most Americans and Canadians actually believe their own eyes and watch. And if you watch the President of the United States in that strange language and the odd breath, the way he breathes, and then talking about his chocolate cake, but then also suddenly calling the president of another country, an animal. And then you watch Assad, and you say, well, he speaks English so much better, and he's so much clearer.
Assad is fluent in three languages, and Donald Trump struggles with one. You know, you have quite a...
It resembles English.
He's got with a very limited vocabulary. It's really now. I think Justin Trudeau had a chance to, you know, to distinguish himself when he called for an investigation. He didn't have to jump on the bandwagon 2 days later and applaud the attack.
No, I think Canadians were proud when he said that and startled when he reversed himself.
You know, as much as his father. I mean, I grew up in Canada, of course, so. I know as much as Trudeau had his limitations, but he actually spoke out strongly against the Vietnam War at various times, and his actions backed him up because he supported America or avoiding the draft and going to Canada. Justin Trudeau had a chance to distinguish himself, and he failed right then, in my opinion.
I'm afraid so. Rick, you've summed it up very nicely for us. That's a great article, and I urge everybody, you find it at the Durand. It's Rick Sterling, investigative journalist. Thank you very, very much for talking.
Okay, all right. Thanks, Bill. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.